Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
World on fire. Guess what? The world is on fire. I'm not referring to environmental degradation or global warming here. No, although that too is true. I refer to protests, not just all across the United States, but all around the world. Protests from London to Paris, from Berlin to Nairobi, from Toledo, Ohio to Tokyo, Japan. Protests in solidarity with Black Lives Matter against police aggression and racism. Protests stemming from the cruel brutality that led to the slow motion killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis, Minnesota. The solidarity from Sydney, Australia stems in part from long-standing discontent from the dark Aborigines, the indigenous communities of Australia and New South Wales, who, like black folk in America, have suffered from generations of state repression. For example, the recent killing of David Dunga, an Aborigine, who, like his brothers and sisters in America, last words, "I can't breathe," as they choked him to death. How have police responded to this challenge? By having temper tantrums. And by attacking protesters, men, women, and even a 75-year-old white man who was pushed to the ground as they stepped over his fallen, bleeding body. America is on fire, and the world has caught the blaze. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
A terrible thing to waste. Environmental racism and its assault on the American mind.
Hundreds of factories, refineries, farms, and mines across the country say they cannot comply with some environmental regulations because of the pandemic. This is according to an NPR review of hundreds of state environmental records. Those records show that companies have asked for a wide range of special permission during this pandemic, including things like delaying checking for leaks in storage tanks and measuring pollution from smokestacks. NPR science reporter Rebecca Hersher is here to talk about this. Hi, Becky.
Hi there.
Okay, so industry is saying there's a pandemic, we need some special allowances here. What exactly are we talking about?
Well, it's a real grab bag. Some of the issues are relatively minor, like submitting an annual report late, but I also found a fair number of substantial requests, mostly from industries that release a lot of pollution, like landfills have been asking states to relax pollution monitoring rules. Hog farms have asked for permission to house extra animals because meatpacking plants were temporarily closed. And oil and gas companies asked for states to back off on enforcement of a wide range of environmental regulations.
I mean, help me understand why an oil or gas company has trouble being able to check for pollution because of a pandemic.
Well, there are a couple of reasons. Maybe furloughs get in the way, like if employees who would usually write and file pollution reports aren't working because of the pandemic. Another reason that companies gave is that a lot of pollution monitoring is done by outside contractors, and they were trying to limit people coming onto facilities because of the virus. We know these details, though, because a small number of states make them public. But another problem here is that no one is systematically keeping track of these types of nationwide requests.
No one keeps an eye on who on these industries and what they're asking for right now? Why is that?
Well, back in March, the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, put out a pandemic policy that said companies don't need to warn federal regulators if they feel like the pandemic is interfering with routine pollution monitoring or testing. Instead, they said states could keep track of that information if they choose to. The EPA says this is how it works. It partners with states, and that is how a lot of environmental regulation works, although former EPA officials say that this policy gives industries a lot of leeway. Now, some states are doing this kind of tracking, but I found that most states don't publish any information about which companies say the pandemic is getting in the way, and that means most Americans who live near factories or refineries, farms, they have no way to know whether the pandemic is causing extra pollution.
I mean, that kind of uncertainty is a big problem for people who live near these sorts of facilities, I would imagine.
Yeah, especially for people who live downstream or downwind of facilities that have violated environmental laws in the past. And I found a fair number of examples like this. So, for example, there's a mine in Indiana. In early April, the mine said it was releasing wastewater with high levels of ammonia and small particles because they were cleaning buildings with a lot of bleach to kill the virus. That same mine, though, has repeatedly violated the Clean Water Act in the past by releasing water with too many small particles in it. And I talked to a local resident who lives downstream. He was really frustrated. His name is John Blair.
The air pollution is visible. The water pollution is less visible. And, you know, I mean, almost anything could be blamed on the virus, I suppose.
Now, the state told the mine to stop releasing water with high levels of ammonia, and many of the requests I looked at were denied. But the only reason we know about that interaction is because Indiana published it publicly, and most states are not doing that, which means most Americans are in the dark.
NPR science reporter Rebecca Hersher. Becky, thanks for that reporting.
Thanks so much.
Nevertheless, they could not understand, and I'm a black man, and I can never be a veteran.
It's been a tumultuous time of nationwide protests against police violence, forcing many to rethink the role of policing in America, as well as the military's role in managing these demonstrations. This past week, President Trump deployed low-flying National Guard helicopters and thousands of federal troops to quell protests in Washington, D.C. Earlier today, President Trump said he's ordered the National Guard to begin withdrawing troops from D.C. That's supposed to take place over the next few days, yet the president made clear that they can quickly return. But former military leaders, once hesitant to speak out, are vocally condemning the president and his decision to mobilize the armed forces in response to protesters. One of them is retired Major General Dana Pittard. He spent decades in the U.S. Army, becoming one of a few African Americans to rise to the level of Major General. And he's here now to share his thoughts on what's been going on throughout the country. Major General Pittard, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you, Sarah.
What was your reaction to how the Trump administration was trying to mobilize the military in response to protesters in recent days?
Yeah, I was surprised, especially when peaceful protesters in Washington, D.C., just outside the White House, were cleared for the president to walk across the street for a photo op, which included the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who unwittingly did that. But I was very concerned with even the threat of using active duty military to quell the protests. What normally happens, it's law enforcement and then the National Guard can be called up by state governors. And in very rare instances, and this is rarely done, the governor of a state can ask the president to send in active duty military.
Yeah, you've said there are occasions when it would be appropriate to use the military in domestic emergencies. What kind of a crisis would rise to that level?
Oh, we've seen that in the past. The riots in L.A., Los Angeles in 1992, following the Rodney King trial verdict, there was a need. The governor of California asked the president then, President George Bush, to do that. But though there were protests throughout the country, most of the protests were in fact peaceful. There was some violence, there was some looting, but that should have been handled first by the National Guard.
You did an interview with Foreign Policy magazine recently in which you discussed some racist incidents that you faced throughout your military career. In it, you recount times where you were reluctant to say something because you were outranked. But you also said that you faced the most egregious forms of racism while you were rising through the ranks, before you joined the leadership ranks. What do you think that says about race in the armed forces?
Well, what it says about race in the armed forces, as well as other segments of society, is, again, the U.S. military is not immune to that. The U.S. military is merely a reflection of the American society in which it serves. It's no better, it's no worse in the U.S. military than it is in the rest of the country.
The last time there were massive protests against police violence was in 2014 during Ferguson. I'm thinking there are people of color serving in the military now, witnessing what's taking place. You wrote about watching Ferguson from Baghdad while leading the initial fight against ISIS at that time. Can you tell us more about what that felt like, fighting one battle abroad while another one was taking place at home?
Yes, in fact, I was watching on TV from my office in Baghdad as we were beginning this fight. And there was an irony to that, in that back in our own country, my own sons, who are African-American, could in fact have been in the same situation as what occurred in Ferguson. I think we as Americans, especially we as African-Americans, are tired of this cycle. It's a cycle of there's an incident, then there's grief, there's outrage, and then there's nothing done. That's why this time, this is different. This time, we must come up with a solution. We as a country must deal with this.
What do you think that solution looks like?
I think there's many aspects of a solution. H.R. 40, which is a bill to talk about setting up a commission for reparations. I don't support monetary reparations, but let's have this discussion of what 401 years ago occurred when the first African slaves were brought over. And the history there of slavery, then and the post-Civil War, Jim Crow laws, and what we're still dealing with.
You've talked about the importance of leadership, especially from white elected officials. What kind of leadership would you have liked to see from President Trump at this time?
Is uniting the country. Be a unifier, not a divider. Be the president of all the United States, not just to his base. But it's the American people who have to resolve this. You know, one leader, though powerful, can certainly make a difference. But to end systemic racism throughout our country, African Americans can't do that by themselves. It takes white Americans and the majority of America to help do that.
That's Dana Pittard, retired Major General from the U.S. Army and co-author of the book Hunting the Caliphate, America's War on ISIS and the Dawn of the Strike Cell. General Pittard, thanks so much for your time.
Sir, thank you.
And sure enough, I mean, when there was nothing but ashes, see, because I witnessed that in 1968 here, on the street where I was, 1606 K Street, Northeast Washington. And it's one block from 8th Street. 8th Street was the hub of black activity. The theaters and grocery stores and drug stores, all of that right down 8th Street. They burned 8th Street to the ground. I mean, you know, fist in air, carrying placards and all that type of thing, you know. And law enforcement people, they just let them burn it. I mean, squad cars were coming just with the sirens going, just racing up and down the street, but they weren't jumping up doing nothing. I mean, they shot a few tear gas canisters and whatnot, but the street burned, you know. And after it was all over, it was just lines of black people, you know, with the little food trucks coming around, all like that, trying to get some water, trying to get some milk. You know. Young black girls out there. My grandmother have to have some milk, you know. My grandmother got to have this. I mean, you know, she got to have her medicine. Ain't no drugstores around here, you know. How's she going to get her medicine? I'm trying to get these prescriptions filled. See, the white supremacists knew that. They let them burn down their neighborhood. You know, all it means is they're going to be out there begging when it's all over. Where are they going to get food? Where are they going to get toilet paper? Now they got to go, you know, go out in the suburbs, get toilet paper. They ain't got no transportation. They burned down the grocery store, you know, Giant Foods. I mean, that's where they got their toilet paper. They don't think ahead. See, they can't think. They're dummies. So that's in my book, you know. I mean, you know, hey, don't participate in no riot.
Some of the early protests over George Floyd's death in police custody sparked looting and vandalism in low-income areas. Residents who live in these neighborhoods are now reeling from the effects of the pandemic and from damage to businesses they depend on. From member station WBEZ in Chicago, Chip Mitchell reports.
On Chicago's west side, Dakobe Smith wanted to stop at a dollar store on the walk home from his shift at a jerk chicken joint, but he can't. The windows are bashed in, and the front doors are swinging freely as water flows out from somewhere inside. It's turned the parking lot into a fetid pond.
This Family Dollar meant a lot to us.
Smith is 30. He lives nearby with his partner and their 7 children, and this store is where they bought most of their essentials.
Bread, milk, cereal, hot dogs, toupees. We don't have stores open in the neighborhood that sell them type of products no more.
Dakobe Smith doesn't have a car, and he's worried about where he'll get his food to feed his family.
My greatest fear right now is just the kids going hungry. Like, the kids. Like, we got to think about the hunger.
As looting subsides in most U.S. cities, teams of young people are out with brooms. Nonprofit groups are setting up small business relief funds, and officials say they're pushing insurers to cut checks and urging big retail chains to quickly reopen. But in wide swaths of Chicago's south and west sides, these efforts likely won't be enough. Some supermarkets, pharmacies, and bank branches remain closed with no signs of repairs or reconstruction. The biggest, Walmart, had several stores looted, and it's making no promises about reopening. Veteran Chicago area developer James Matanke owns and manages shopping centers in low-income neighborhoods.
It is so difficult to get a good retailer to go into an underserved market where it is more difficult for them to believe that they will make money. If they have to deal with extra security issues, if they have to deal with theft, if they have to deal with rebuilding their stores, they might think twice and not come back.
Then there are small businesses. Cal State Long Beach business professor Laura Gonzalez says the pandemic has already brought many of them to the breaking point.
If they are being looted now, they just do not have the cash to rebuild, and they will not be able to get loans.
No loans for rebuilding, she says, because the banks won't take the risk. Stacy Sutton teaches urban planning at the University of Illinois at Chicago. She predicts low-income areas won't get much public help either.
How we use tax dollars and where they get allocated tends to be high-wealth areas. When we have an uprising, historically that's what we've seen. And the reticence from many of our elected officials to redevelop becomes punitive. Well, you destroyed your neighborhood, therefore we're not going to reinvest.
And then there's still another challenge in cities like Chicago. Scarcity of food, medicines, and household products could ratchet up neighborhood tensions as we head into a hot summer. Jesse Duncan heads a violence prevention program on the West Side.
There are some things someone may have that others don't. And when you see someone that has it, you go get it. I feel like there will be a lot more.
Last Sunday, Chicago's worst day of looting, the city had 15 homicide deaths, the most in at least 36 years, according to WBEZ's analysis. Gun violence continued at elevated levels all week. It could make the poorest neighborhoods even less attractive to retailers and lenders.
The food desert just got more deserted.
A block from the destroyed dollar store, Marshall Hatch is senior pastor of New Mount Pilgrim Missionary Baptist Church. He says he's turning the church into a free food distributor. But he says much more will be needed in neighborhoods like his because there's no real safety net.
Race has skewed that in America. America does not necessarily see African Americans as really part of the family and worthy of having a safety net.
Pastor Hatch fears the unrest that's shaken the country after George Floyd's death will continue. For NPR News, I'm Chip Mitchell in Chicago.
Medical apartheid, the dark history of medical experimentation on Black Americans from colonial times to the present.
A few short weeks after states across the U.S. started to open up, several are starting to see noticeable spikes in their coronavirus cases. Nationwide, the virus is still killing more than 800 people every day. To talk about where this is headed, I am joined by NPR's global health correspondent, Nareet Eisenman. Hey, Nareet.
Hi, Mary Louise.
So we know more than 100,000 people in the U.S. have died from COVID-19. You have been talking to the scientists who put together forecasts of the pandemic's course. What are they forecasting?
Well, the short answer, tens of thousands more deaths on top of what we've already seen between now and early fall. One model comes from Yuyang Gu. He's actually not affiliated with any institution, just an MIT-trained individual, but his forecast has proved notably accurate, and it's widely admired by the experts. He projects more than 100,000 additional deaths by October 1st. Today, another prominent team, the University of Washington's Institute of Health Metrics and Evaluation, they unveiled a forecast through October 1st of about 80,000 more deaths by then.
And what is driving this?
Well, to get just a little technical here, what's key is what's called the reproduction number, or the R, which tells you for each individual who's infected, how many people do they go on to infect? When that number is above one, that's what gives you an upward spiral, an exponential explosion in cases. So, for example, if that reproduction number is two, then that first person goes on to infect two others. Those two people go on to infect four people. Those four go on to infect eight, then 16. Within a month, that one person has launched a chain that has infected 127 people. So to stop that exponential growth, you need to bring this reproduction number below one.
Which was the whole point, as I recall, of all the measures that states took back in March that we all, or most of us, were taking back in March. It was trying to bring down this reproduction number.
Exactly, the stay-at-home measures. And it makes sense. If people have fewer face-to-face interactions, then one person who's infected with COVID-19 is going to have fewer chances to spread it. And get this, say the reproduction number is brought way below one, like 0.5, then 100 people spread it to just 50, who spread it to 25, and eventually the virus peters out. Now, during that stay-at-home period this spring, the U.S. managed to bring the reproduction number down, some states like New York, by a lot. But nationally, we got it just barely below one. And that means that, okay, we stopped the spiraling upwards, but we essentially only got things to, like, a steady state, each infected person passing it on to one new person, creating a kind of steady drip of new infections, which means every day more deaths, and that over time adds up.
And what you're telling us now is that as states and businesses reopen, that reproduction number is now rising.
Yes. So one of those modelers I mentioned, Yuyang Gu, he's calculated that in about two-thirds of states now, the reproduction number has already crept up above one.
I have to ask, Narit, whether we know, is it possible to know, is any of this due to the recent protests sparked by the death of George Floyd? I was out covering those protests. It is really hard to socially distance when you're in the streets with tens of thousands of people.
Absolutely. Now, it's very hard to calculate the impact of that because we don't have a lot of previous experience to be able to say when people are in a demonstration, you know, how many get infected. On the one hand, yeah, you have people standing shoulder to shoulder, shouting. There have also been arrests, which causes infections. On the other hand, it's outside. Many people were wearing masks. And, of course, it looks like a lot of the demonstrators skewed young, so those who do get infected are less likely to have serious outcomes. But there's an important point here that gets missed in that whole phrasing of the question, and that's one that was brought up to me by Mark Lipsitch. He's an epidemiologist at Harvard. Let's have a listen.
Some transmissions will almost certainly happen at the protests. And the question is whether those lead to a lot of cases down the line or a relatively small number of cases down the line.
So what really matters is what happens after the marches. Do those who are infected at a march go into an environment where a high level of where there's a high level of ongoing transmission or a low level? Here's Lipsitch again.
How much transmission happens later on is far more dependent on our actions as a society and whether we can suppress transmission around the country than on how many people go to the protests.
In other words, you know, maybe the question we should be asking is not, will the demonstrators cause a spike in COVID-19 infections, but will all of us, the public, officials, behave in a way moving forward that ensures that these marches and the improvements to racial equality that they might achieve down the line, that that doesn't end up coming at a cost of many more COVID deaths? You know, in other words, it's really up to us.
All right. And meanwhile, let me ask you a weather question, a seasonal question, because there was all this talk about a second wave that was going to come in the late fall, in the winter. What do we know about that?
Right. And this is a slightly confusing way to express it, that the second wave idea, because, of course, we never really had a wave that crested. It just we just started opening up before the daily cases could go down. But that said, Chris Murray, the lead researcher at the IHME modeling team, says that there's now enough evidence that the virus is seasonal to expect that when the weather gets colder, we are going to see another upsurge of cases, and that would be kind of in the like late September, October, really taking off in November.
Okay, a very sobering picture there from NPR Global Health correspondent Nurit Eisenman. Thank you very much, Nurit.
You're welcome.
That there was no such place. I had a vague idea that Rio de Janeiro was a place, so I kind of kept that in the back of my mind in reserve. And if all these other places fail, I could probably wind up join the Navy or something and go to Rio, and I could escape for a few minutes from being black. And a lot of black people thought that way in the back of their minds. They were looking for a place. That's the gist of what I'm saying. But the racists, this thing called white supremacy over a period of years, about 1957 while I was in Japan, I began to realize that you got to turn around and just grab it. It's no place to run.
They are the figures the Brazilian president, Jair Bolsonaro, did not want to see when he told the government to stop publishing coronavirus numbers. However, that order was overturned, and on Friday evening, the health ministry announced another 909 deaths from COVID-19, taking the overall figure in Brazil to 41,828, the second highest in the world after the US and now ahead of the UK. Brazil has nearly 830,000 infections, second only to the US as well. And some parts of the Brazilian health system are under strain. Michael Ryan is head of the WHO's Health Emergencies Program.
The situation in Brazil is of concern. All 27 areas are affected. We've seen different rates of infection. There are clear hotspots in heavily populated areas. There are clearly differential impacts in different populations. We've seen the impact in Amazonas. But overall, the health system is still coping in Brazil.
I heard more from our Sao Paulo correspondent, Katie Watson.
It was a number that everybody here was predicting. Everybody here was also, you know, deeply concerned, knowing, if you like, that this is going to happen. Jair Bolsonaro has continued to downplay this virus. He has said very little this week. And in fact, it's got to such a point that people here, you know, you've got Sao Paulo, you've got Rio, you've got these cities that are starting to reopen at the time of crisis. People here are deeply concerned about where this is going. And we hear very little from the top.
We've had that warning about hotspots from the WHO's Michael Ryan, and he says that some intensive care units are at critical levels.
Absolutely, and he mentioned Amazonas up in the Amazon region. Manaus was one of the cities a month or so ago that was, you know, really hard hit there. They've got some of the highest infection rates. Here in Sao Paulo, it's the epicenter in terms of pure absolute numbers. And that's something that Mr. Ryan also talked about, that they're still coping, because here in Sao Paulo, it's a massive city, the biggest city in the southern hemisphere, so their health system is managing at the moment. But he did mention the fact that there are some hotspots, some more populated areas where occupancy rates are 90% or more, and that is the concern. Of course, we don't know where we are in terms of the curve. Brazil tests very little, and the belief is that the real numbers are much, much higher than the official figures are giving out.
Of course, Brazil also has a big population, and it is a big country, so it should ultimately be able to cope, should it?
The fact that it is such a big country is also one of the biggest challenges. There are, you know, the south of Brazil is so very different from up in the north. And I was talking to one infectologist who said that one of the big issues is just getting like tests down from areas such as the Amazon, because transport logistics makes things much more difficult, and therefore the tests get ruined. I mean, it's the logistics as well, which is causing a big challenge for Brazil, getting ventilators, getting equipment that's needed across the whole of the country. Now, the government has erred, could have done a lot more to help, but I think also the size, the scale, and the difference in the country certainly doesn't help its cause.
Katie Watson in Sao Paulo.
From imprisoned nation.
Last night, a judge ruled that North Carolina prisons must do more to protect inmates during the coronavirus outbreak. The ruling says the state has to come up with a plan to test every inmate for COVID-19 and limit inmate transfers from prison to prison. The ruling comes in a lawsuit filed by the ACLU of North Carolina, NAACP, and other activist groups that argues that inmates must be released. I'm joined by Jordan Wilkie. He's a Report for America Corps fellow working for Carolina Public Press. Hello, Jordan.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Well, tell us more about the lawsuit. What does it allege?
So the lawsuit was brought to allege that in the specific conditions under COVID-19, the conditions within prisons are unconstitutional because there is no way for people to protect themselves from a potential illness.
And what relief does it seek? What does the lawsuit say should be done?
The lawsuit doesn't have a very specific remedy. What they suggest is that a significant number of people need to be released from prison so that in each prison facility, people can achieve social distancing from each other, which they say is the only way that people can effectively protect themselves from COVID-19, such as we're doing on the outside.
All right, so let's hear more about yesterday's Superior Court ruling. What does it say and what's the effect?
The ruling has some to-be-decided factors to it. So the judge gave a loose 48 hours to the parties in the case to write an order for the judge to review, and then he will make whatever changes he desires and then put that ruling into effect. So we don't have an actual order in place that is directing the state to do a certain number of things as of yet. The judge did say that the parties in the case need to present plans to him by noon on June 22nd, one, to test every person who is incarcerated in North Carolina for COVID-19, and two, to create a plan to ensure that all of the COVID-19 measures to protect people are executed with fidelity across all the different prisons.
So that, in effect, is a ruling. In other words, the state is now, at least by this ruling, ordered to come up with a plan for testing every inmate. Am I right about that?
Yes, that is part of the ruling. But there is going to be a broader set of directives that are in process at this moment.
All right. So then so at this point, until that all happens, there's no real deadline for that mass testing to begin or to end, right?
That's correct.
And would staff be tested as well as part of this ruling?
That hasn't been indicated here, but staff, there's already a plan in place that will continue through the end of July that allows staff to get testing for COVID-19 at a number of places that are outside of their prisons. That plan has been critiqued by SEANC and Artis Watkins, which is the organization that represents prison staff, for being inaccessible to some people. But that is what's in place. And over 1,000 correctional officers in North Carolina have reported being tested for COVID-19 through this process so far. And I believe as of yesterday, 18 had tested positive.
Yeah. And to be clear, there are right now about more than 32,000 people currently held in North Carolina prisons. So that's kind of the total number we're looking at. Let's dive into the evidence now that the judge was looking at. The plaintiff's main point is that there's simply not enough room in North Carolina's prisons for these 32,000 people to socially distance, and they suggest that releasing the inmates was one of the best options. Meanwhile, the Department of Public Safety says the prisons have taken adequate measures. So let's start with the Department of Security, the prison department in the state. What's their argument? What are they saying they've done already?
Well, the Department of Public Safety has a really extensive list of things that they have done. They froze work release, and they froze a number of programs that would release people who are incarcerated into the community to work or to visit home or to do any number of things. And it also limited the number of people who are coming into the prison system. Now, our reporting found that there was some wiggle room in that NCCIW, North Carolina Correctional Institute for Women, continued to work at the DPS offices to clean them until people became ill with COVID in April. But in general, there have been a very long list of things that DPS has put into place. The basic argument of the litigation, though, is that any number of protections can be put in place, but unless the key protection, which is keeping people at least 6 feet apart and having some social distance so that they can keep themselves from getting affected, unless that's put in place, then really the rest is nice, but not ultimately going to be effective at protecting people effective. From illness.
And the plaintiff said that even the steps that were put in place weren't enough. I mean, you talked about one, women from the women's prison coming to clean DPS offices. They had then that prison had the second largest outbreak in the prison system, if I'm not wrong. Is that right?
Yep, you're correct.
All right. And there was other evidence that DPS was not following through even on their promises, this according to the lawsuit. What were some of the inconsistencies that were pointed out in the lawsuit?
Well, there was a pretty strong argument between the plaintiffs and the state about what social distancing meant and whether or not it was being followed. There were disagreements about when certain protections, masks were being delivered to facilities, when people had access to them, how effective of an intervention that actually was. There were a number of people who were transferred during the period of moratorium on transfers, except for a couple of exceptions. And the information is not necessarily available to know whether or not DPS truly limited the transfers to those exceptions, but the information was available to know that there were transfers from people in prisons with COVID to prisons without COVID, and from people in prisons with without COVID into prisons with COVID, which could have been a risk to them. And so there were just a number of disagreements about the actual implementation of policy and its effectiveness at protecting people in the state custody.
And the judge heard testimony from a variety of sources, affidavits submitted by former and current inmates, also suggesting that the prisons weren't waiving the cost of medical copays as they said they would. Is that right? That part of this argument or some of what came up during this case?
That actually came from a call that I received from a woman in North Carolina Correctional Institute for Women. That specific allegation is part of a larger set of concerns that the ACLU has presented, as well as other advocacy organizations have received letters and other news organizations have been contacted saying effectively people are seeing people, other people in prisons with symptoms related to COVID-19. They are not seeing medical staff. They are not seeing that people with symptoms are being tested quickly or being quarantined. There is a general indication that there is poor communication between prison staff and people who are incarcerated, and there are very high rates of stress and tension. And all of that is, putting people at risk for a security concern that's been mentioned both by DPS and by various observers of the prison system, saying that the fact that COVID-19 is stressing people inside and that people are not feeling that they are being protected or treated adequately could potentially be a security concern and is certainly increasing stress within the system.
And a big part of this story generally and implicit in the lawsuit is that the DPS has not been forthcoming with all the information, that even the information they're getting, if we got all the information, would indicate a far larger problem than we think we know about right now. Is that part of this?
Yes, that's the allegation of the ACLU. The main concern here is that not enough people are being tested in order to know the full scope of the problem, and therefore the interventions that the Department of Public Safety is implementing are not effective because they're playing a game without the cards. You can't take effective action when you don't know exactly what's going on. And that is according to affidavits filed by public health experts and to the arguments made by the ACLU.
And that's really the part of this that the judge has addressed, while the larger concern of the groups who brought the suit or suggestion would be to depopulate these prisons. The judge didn't order that, but rather got the testing in place and at least the planning for the testing to get underway. Is that right?
To a degree, the judge issued some guidance that will be reflected in the order that is eventually put out around releasing people from prison. So there's certainly an aspect of this that will direct the prison system to decrease its population. What that exactly looks like remains to be seen. The judge, I had a conversation with the ACLU staff attorney who's been lead on this case, Leah Kang, and she said that the judge basically directed through his bench memo the parties to consider prioritizing people who are already close to release, and he gave some guidance on how to do that. And some guidance on how to think about, in general, reducing the prison population.
All right, Jordan Wilkie, a Report for America Corps fellow working for the Carolina Public Press. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me on.
New York Times, all the news that's fit to print, editorial.
The fight over racial justice has found its way inside some of the country's leading newsrooms. Yesterday, the editorial page editor for the New York Times, James Bennett, stepped down. This after many of his colleagues protested the paper's decision to publish an op-ed by Republican Senator Tom Cotton that advocated the use of the military to quell civil unrest. And the Philadelphia Inquirer's executive editor resigned after the paper ran the headline, Buildings Matter Too, atop a column on rioting. Reporters argued it equated property damage to human life. Now, NPR's David Folkenflik offers a story about a third paper where editors' decisions involving black journalists have inspired a backlash.
In the biggest newsroom in Pittsburgh, a firestorm has erupted over one of its own, Alexis Johnson.
I'm 27 years old. I am a reporter at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette.
And she's a Pittsburgh native. Even though she's fairly new to reporting, she wanted to jump into the big story.
Monday morning, I had came in and I had pitched like four story ideas. You know, these are very much my friends and family and community members that were out there in the streets protesting against police brutality in the black community.
Instead, she was called by the paper's managing editor and two other top editors. They pointed to a tweet she'd sent out the night before, comparing the damage caused by looters with photos showing the debris-strewn aftermath of a country music star's concert there.
It's almost a running joke in Pittsburgh. You know, people know it's infamous what happens after these Kenny Chesney concerts when he comes into town.
She said editors called her up and accused her of betraying bias.
They kept doubling down, saying I gave my opinion through the tweet and that my opinion came through in the tweet. And I don't think that's the case at all. I think people made their own opinions of what I was trying to say. I thought it was kind of clever.
And so they barred Johnson, an African-American reporter who's the daughter of a state trooper and a probation officer, from covering a story in her hometown about police and racial justice. Editors also sidelined a black photographer, Michael Santiago. They are among just a handful of black journalists at the paper. The controversy lays bare the tension between a pursuit of impartiality that has been a journalistic tenet for three quarters of a century, and a new urgency felt especially keenly among younger journalists and journalists of color to bear witness to what they're seeing. Alexis Johnson says she believes her editors discriminated against her because of her race. Why would she say that? Let's meet her colleague, Joshua Axelrod.
I'm 28, and I'm a digital sports producer at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette.
For the record, Axelrod is white. Like Johnson, Axelrod is also a Pittsburgh native, and also pretty new. A week ago, Axelrod wrote an article about a man police accused of participating in vandalism and looting downtown. Axelrod tweeted about it, calling the accused man a vulgar slang word.
Not a very sound journalistic decision, admittedly.
Like Johnson, he was reprimanded by editors last Monday about his tweet. He erased it. These are his first public comments about his circumstances.
It felt like the nation and my city were undergoing a very tough time, and it was tough to separate myself as a journalist and just a person in the world. And I recognize the mistake I made, but it came from a place of emotions running high.
Yet Axelrod says he received no directive preventing him from covering stories involving the protests. In fact, he posted another article the very next day. The News Guild weighed in, noting that Johnson had been treated more severely than Axelrod. The paper didn't relent against Johnson. Instead, the Post-Gazette then banned Axelrod from protest coverage, too. Axelrod tells me he supports Johnson and Santiago.
I made a legitimate journalistic mistake. I do not think either of them did.
Managing editor Karen Kane and executive editor Keith Burris did not respond to detailed requests for comment. The paper's union has scheduled a press conference for later this morning. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
So you as long as the system of white supremacy exists, you don't see
word anything. Masters. See what I mean?
President Kennedy Mitchum has a very nice ring to it, so.
A fluorescent woman making international news. She petitioned Webster Dictionary to have the word racism change, and she succeeded. News 11's Vic Faust has her inspiring story.
Meet Kennedy Mitchum. Someday she just might be president.
I just think that, you know, President Kennedy Mitchum has a very nice ring to it, so stay tuned.
Mitchum is making international headlines this week after convincing Merriam-Webster Dictionary to include more on their current definition of the word racism. She has been doing TV, radio, and print all around the world. Here is the current definition.
A belief that race is the primary determinant of human traits and capacities, and that racial differences produce an inherent superiority of a particular race.
Do you know what Webster's is going to add to the dictionary yet?
All I know for sure is that they're going to add systemic oppression and make sure that that's a bigger part of the dictionary definition.
Mitchum, a Florissant native, Nerick's Hall graduate, and recent graduate of Drake University with a degree in law, politics, and society, says she felt compelled to show people what she has lived with and seen her entire life.
I don't feel like a star. I just feel like I just spoke on what a lot of people of color already kind of understood and knew. So I was just glad that it was actually being heard and it was being understood.
Mitchum is now receiving many calls about her future. Whether she runs for president or not someday, she wants one thing to be known.
I just want people to actually look at the change and learn as much as they can, educate themselves so we can all come together. That's what's important.
Mitchum also has a communications degree and might decide to use her platform in journalism. But for now, she's also helping the effort to make sure all dictionaries amend their meaning of racism, like Merriam-Webster.
And I watch the news like, nigga, what the fuck I'm supposed to tell my kids? So fuck your city ordinance. This is for the flourishing. So hot in her, and that's where the West floors. We seem to keep you shooting. Bring the chorus in. For real.
It's off the top at 4 o'clock this afternoon. The Florissant police chief has fired the detective seen in this video hitting a suspect with his patrol car. Also, for the first time, we are learning the now former Florissant detective's name is Joshua Smith. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us. I'm Claire Kellett. We want to get right out to News 4's Alexis Soto. Alexis was at that press conference that just wrapped up within the last half hour.
Claire, the Florissant police chief says he has been listening and talking to protesters who have been outside the police department here for the last several days, but that this decision to fire Detective Joshua Smith comes after a careful review of the incident itself, saying that there were multiple violations seen. Joshua Smith was a 9-year veteran of this department. He is the one, according to the police chief, that you see in this Ring camera video, striking a man with his car and then kicking and hitting him when he's on the ground. The police chief said the video is upsetting and disturbing and that the actions are not appropriate. The chief said this isn't the end of the investigation. There is an internal investigation on why it took several days for the chief to be made fully aware of how this all went down.
I'm not going to stand here and make a single excuse for anything that occurred that night, including the breakdown in communication. I will only say to you that there were a lot of moving parts that evening, you know, and just some perspective from you. The command post that was established at the time was running out of a facility here in the city of Florissant, and there were a lot of moving parts. I should have known there is no excuse. You know, it's, again, something that we're going to have to dig further into as far as our internal review goes.
So the other two officers that were in that car remain on paid leave tonight. The chief says at this point there does not appear to be wrongdoing on their part. Now, a lot of people want to know what is happening with the criminal investigation. Will this detective face criminal charges? That is out of the hands of the Florissant Police Department. That will be the decision of the outside agencies who are investigating. That includes St. Louis County Police Department, the St. Charles County Prosecutor's Office, as well as the FBI. Reporting live, Alexis Soto, News 4.
This question, why is this stuff happening? happening. The New York Times editorial today. The Trump effect. See, this is what I'm doing with my money, buying newspapers like Dick Gregory. The Trump effect and how it spreads. It says we are on the brink, under Trump, on the brink of fascism. New York Times, all the news that's fit to print, editorial 1210-2015. I say fascism is end-stage white supremacy. See, just like in Nazi Germany. Fascism, system of racism, white supremacy, determined to survive.
The COVID-19 pandemic and nationwide protests against police violence have put the country on edge, but the unrest appears to be a recruiting opportunity for some anti-government groups. Guns in America's Heath Druzan reports.
This is the sound of hundreds of pounds of potatoes hitting the bottom of a dump truck. It's April in rural southern Idaho. The spuds belong to a local farmer who couldn't sell them, so he's giving them away for free as the unemployment rate soars. The dump truck driver is a member of a local anti-federal militia, the Real Three Percenters of Idaho. Eric Parker leads the group.
That's always the directive during an emergency with the organization, whether it's man-made or natural. It's look around your community and see where you can help and organize to help.
Parker shot to fame after a photo of him pointing a rifle at federal agents during a 2014 standoff at a Nevada ranch hit screens across the country. He faced a long prison sentence, but pleaded guilty to a single misdemeanor. Handing out potatoes is a softer side to a group that does tactical weapons training and posts videos like this one titled, "When They Come for Your Guns, Step 1, Don't Let Them." Critics say these charity efforts are publicity stunts meant to mainstream groups they see as dangerous. Speaking at a park in Haley, Idaho, Parker said there's no agenda other than helping the community.
I've heard that many times from elected officials, you know, let no good crisis go to waste. And that's not us. This is what we were doing before.
Parker says the pandemic has driven more people to his group. That worries Amy Hertzfeld-Koppel.
This is a major recruiting opportunity, and we're seeing a lot of tactics by far-right militias and extremist organizations to mainstream their appeal right now.
Hertzfeld-Koppel is with the Western State Center, a left-leaning organization that monitors anti-government movements. She and other extremism experts say Americans' understandable fears during these crises play into the hands of militias.
They're doing their best to leverage fear and uncertainty in many communities to broaden their political power and influence.
Hertzfeld-Koppel sees events like the potato giveaway and other far-right groups raising funds for businesses and churches as a way to make the movement look less threatening. And there are signs it's working. A newspaper report on another potato drive in North Idaho referred to the militia simply as a nonprofit. Molly Page is an Idaho political activist whose causes don't normally dovetail with Three Percenters. She was a key member of a recent effort to expand Medicaid in Idaho. She organized an early potato giveaway and said she welcomed the militia member who offered his dump truck.
As one of my friends was joking, I don't care what percent you are. You know, we need help and we need people to come help us transport the potatoes.
Across the country, militia members have been active in recent months. Some voice support for protests against police violence, while some armed groups have clashed with protesters. Militia members and police have squared off in Texas over stay-at-home orders. And in Michigan, the state legislature suspended its session after armed protesters took to the Capitol while thousands honked their horns outside. George Saleem served under the Bush, Obama, and Trump administrations, monitoring domestic extremism at the Department of Homeland Security and National Security Council. He's now with the Anti-Defamation League. Saleem says the federal government has been slow to take the threat of domestic extremism seriously.
For a long time, there has been a bit of an imbalanced focus in this country that the only threat that we face to our country and to our public safety comes from outside the country.
Andy says it's unclear where the Trump administration stands on anti-government groups. At one point, Trump tweeted, quote, "Liberate Michigan," seemingly in defiance of his own health experts' guidance to stay at home.
The messaging coming out of the executive branch has been so confusing and so convoluted.
It's still to be seen how lasting the recruiting gains are. A who's who of anti-government activists is planning a Liberate America rally Saturday in North Idaho. For Guns and America, I'm Heath Rusin.
The South Jersey Donald Trump supporters physically mocked George Floyd's death as peaceful protesters passed by yesterday in Franklin Township.
Tonight, one of the men in the video has been suspended from his state job as a corrections officer. NBC 10 South Jersey Bureau reporter Sydney Long has the video that's making national headlines.
I cannot unsee something like that.
Darian Fennell wishes she and fellow demonstrators could erase some of the images of Monday's march down Delcy Drive when a group of people on private property staged a counter-protest just feet from the road. In this video shared with NBC 10, you can see a man kneeling on the chest of a person on the ground as they heckled those marching peacefully using the words, Black Lives Matter to no one.
Immediately, I was very, like, tears. I started crying, like,
Fennell is thankful her group had a police escort.
God forbid they weren't. Who knows how that situation would have escalated.
Franklin Township released a statement. It reads in part, the Franklin Township Committee and its police department are appalled and saddened by the revolting actions of certain individuals after Monday's locally organized peaceful march. This is not who we are as a community.
They were just using their First Amendment rights or whatever, but it's still not okay.
A young demonstrator who didn't want to show her face says she's participated in more than six protests recently.
The first time I saw something this horrifying, that it was in my hometown, you know. So I really hope that the people in this video are recognized. I hope that people of the community come out and say, you know, hey, I know so-and-so in that video.
Police are continuing their investigation into what happened, and we also tried unsuccessfully to get in touch with the people in that video. As you can see, a small number of demonstrators gathered here today holding their signs as motorists who drove by honk their horns. Another peaceful protest is planned for Franklin Township this Saturday. Beverly Merritt says police may not waive permit fees and are pressing for a number for crowd control.
He said, we just want to keep you people safe. I said, what do you mean by you people? We're not, I told him, you sound like you're preparing for war already. We're coming in peace.
But maybe there's going to be like new policies or new laws or something's going to change. Maybe we will touch someone's heart so that they have a change of heart.
Reporting in Franklin Township, Sydney Long, NBC 10 News.
The death of George Floyd has struck a nerve in France. Many people there are drawing a direct comparison between Floyd's death and that of a black Frenchman who died after being pinned by police officers in a Paris suburb in 2016. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports.
A week after George Floyd's death, 20,000 Parisians defied coronavirus restrictions and demanded justice for 24-year-old Adama Traoré. Traoré died in July 2016. His family and a core support group have always said he was asphyxiated when three policemen pinned him to the ground. Now the rest of France thinks they might have a point. Mathieu Zagrodsky is a lecturer on law enforcement at the University of Versailles.
The George Floyd earthquake really had this tremendous influence on French society, and a lot of people had this sort of, maybe not epiphany, but they realized that, hey, we've been talking about this police brutality problem, this police versus minority problem in France, and there are parallels to draw between the French and American situations.
Zagrodsky says both French and American police overwhelmingly target minorities, but when it comes to violence, he says there is no comparison. French police kill 10 to 15 people a year. American police kill more than 1,000. At a rally this week, protesters evoked a high-profile police killing of another black man more than 30 years ago. Franco-American Idriss Mbodu was there. He grew up in the U.S. and now lives in France.
In the States, me as a black man, like every time that I see a police officer and it's serious, you know, I have to always think, am I going to get shot? You know, I don't feel that as much in France. No. I feel that it's more egalitarian, or it attempts to be more egalitarian. I feel freer here.
Though Mbodu admits that black Americans do enjoy a special kind of status in France. France became a haven for African-American writers, musicians, and artists looking to escape Jim Crow America. But other French blacks say racism is rampant, it's just more hidden and subtle than in America. Marie-Jeanne Mbokolo was born in France to Congolese parents.
France is a very hypocrite country. They look at the USA and say, oh my God, it's so racist country, but our country is so racist, even in the institution. For example, in school, when your parents are African, they make you feel like you're not French.
France does not keep statistics on race on the principle that everyone is equal under the Republic. Actor Thierry Picot says that does not make France colorblind.
American people know that there's racism in the country. Here, everyone wants to pretend like it's nothing. So I'm actually very surprised and almost emotional today being here because I've been to many protests and it's the first time that I see so many white people.
Aujourd'hui, c'est le monde entier qui se lève.
Beyond the Adama Traoré case, George Floyd's death is pushing France into a national conversation about racism within the police and society as a whole.
De la prise par le coup, dite de l'étranglement, sera abandonnée.
This week, French Interior Minister Christophe Castaner announced a ban on the use of chokeholds by the police and said there would be zero tolerance for racism in law enforcement. Tomorrow, there will be more protests to demand that Adama Traoré's case be reopened. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
That, y'all. It's like that, y'all. I don't really give a fuck about it at all. Cause the same people that try to blackball me forget about two things, my black balls.
Basically about an inch by an inch. It's hard rubber. This is one of the things they shoot.
Just across the street, Derek Sanderland saw police shooting rubber bullets at protesters, including young women at close range. There's Officer Jarrett Yuen, who has already been placed on desk duty, facing an internal affairs investigation for his aggressive behavior.
I really just couldn't watch it anymore. And just kind of made like a parallel walk over, put my hands up, and just stood in the line of the fire. And ask them to please not do this.
The video shows the officers training their riot guns on Sanderland. He stood a good distance away, made no aggressive motions to police, yet they fired on him several times, one round hitting him in the groin.
My black balls.
I paused for a moment, like maybe this doesn't hurt, and following afterwards, it was like the most painful experience.
Things have happened. It's amazing when I talk to people and they say, man, I've been seeing folks protest and nothing has happened. When in reality, there are 40 new laws in 24 states. You would not have the number of police departments' body cameras. You now have city councils that are now looking at the police union contracts.
Amazon says it will temporarily stop giving law enforcement agencies access to its facial recognition software. Earlier this week, IBM said it would stop its work on this type of technology. NPR's Bobby Allen has been reporting on all of this. And before we get started, I will note that NPR does get financial support from Amazon. Bobby, good morning.
Good morning.
So Amazon is the place that a lot of us get a lot of our stuff, but it also has a more low-key, though thriving business, providing facial recognition software to law enforcement. Tell us about that business.
Sure. It's called Recognition. Amazon spells that with a K. And in recent years, they have been selling it to police departments. And police departments have been using it to identify potential suspects by checking photos against a giant database of mugshots that are stored digitally in the cloud. But then a bunch of studies took a really hard look at this tool and found a lot of problems. So this facial recognition tool has a hard time correctly identifying people with darker skin, harder time identifying women and younger people. One audit even found when members of Congress were ran through this Amazon tool that nearly two dozen of them were matched to people who had been arrested for committing crimes. So those were false matches. Yeah. So I talked to an MIT researcher. Her name is Joy Bulamwini, and she has been studying Amazon's technology, and here's her assessment.
Racial biases, gender bias, even has age bias. But even if that bias wasn't there, there's still the capacity for abuse. And most concerningly, especially as we're seeing more people take to the streets, is the specter of using facial recognition for surveillance.
So as Bolognini says, the protests across the country have created some intense concern about the algorithms here. And, you know, that fear about mass surveillance this week drove IBM to abandon its facial recognition line of business completely.
Okay, I do understand the concern about mass surveillance. How are police departments actually using it?
Yeah, so this is how it works. So say you get pulled over and a deputy comes up to you. The deputy can take your photo with his phone and upload that into this system. And the system will scan hundreds of thousands of mugshots and see if you have been arrested for a crime in the past several years. They could even do this with someone's social media photo. They can do it with sort of a grainy security camera picture. And police say this is really helpful when a suspect, you know, refuses to give their name or when they're, you know, looking at someone on a crime scene who is unconscious. But, you know, the MIT researcher I talked to, Bolognini, she's worried about, you know, use of this technology outside of government, about people who can use it for other uses.
You know, Bobby, I wonder, did Amazon come right out and cop to doing this, to making this move because of the protests over George Floyd's killing and over racial injustice in this country?
You know, Noel, that's certainly the backdrop here, but in Amazon's really brief announcement, they made no mention of George Floyd's name. They did not say anything about the unrest we're seeing. Instead, they said they're halting the facial recognition software in order to allow Congress to develop some regulations. And, you know, this creep into what some people call policing by algorithm has caused pushback from even inside of Amazon. Some of Amazon's own investors and employees have real fears about this and have made them known.
But what does it mean for law enforcement agencies that were already using it?
Yeah, so Amazon has never revealed a complete list of all of the law enforcement agencies that use this technology, but I did talk to the sheriff's office in Washington County, Oregon. It's the third largest law enforcement agency in the state. They were using it quite a bit, and they said, since we heard that Amazon is forcing us to stop, we're going to stop, so they're not going to be using it for at least the next year.
Okay, but one thing we all know about businesses in competition is that somebody's going to step in and fill the void, right? There's got to be an Amazon competitor out there like, we got it.
Yeah, right. So Microsoft also has similar technology. There's other IT and surveillance companies that offer a similar service. So just because Amazon is halting doesn't mean it's going to go away.
NPR's Bobby Allen, such interesting reporting. Thanks, Bobby.
Thank you, Noel.
And you were saying, like, they got it either way. If you say, well, we want police officers, okay, we can put black people here and have black people beat you up. We can have white people here and have white people beat you up. You say, okay, we don't want any police officers. Fine, no problem.
Fine, no problem there, right. You know, now your niggas are just killing each other. I mean, ain't nobody coming. When you call 911, good luck with that. Ain't nobody coming. You know?
Exactly. It's like they, that's what a system means. Like they got it.
That's right. Yeah.
They got it any way they want to deal with you. Like just.
In other words, all you black people out here complaining about somebody broke in your car and somebody did this and all like that, we'll call, you know, hey, you finally eliminate all the black police and then all of what you call the racist police. So, we're going to send Barney Fife. I mean, you know, good luck with that.
Defund the police is a call that's swept through protests and into the broader conversation about American policing. This week, we're looking at what that would actually mean. We've heard from a police chief who rebuilt his department from scratch in New Jersey and a group of social workers who respond to 911 calls in Oregon. Today, two people who've spent years studying what it would mean to defund the police. First, St. Louis activist and lawyer Derica Purnell. She would like to abolish the police entirely, and she told me the first step is changing how we think about stopping crime.
For example, if someone sexually assaults someone or someone kills someone because they're homophobic, calling a police officer is not going to stop people from becoming homophobic. Right, it can only put that particular person in a cage, in a box, in prison. But it doesn't actually get to the root of the problem, which is homophobia or toxic masculinity, for example. How do we transform society? How do we respond to harm alternatively that doesn't create more harm, but actually can stop harm and save more lives?
So you're talking about investing in everything from education to mental health to homeless services. Can you really envision a point where those investments result in zero crime, zero need for law enforcement?
Oh, well, so two things. One, what we consider crime and harm, first of all, it's a social construct. We get to decide what that is.
And so you're saying part of defunding the police is changing the laws to decriminalize things that we now think of as criminal offenses?
Absolutely. Just like marijuana. So, you know, 10 years ago, it was illegal if you were in California or in Colorado or in the District of Columbia to use marijuana. Now it's not. Those things have been decriminalized. So that removes enforcement power from the police to stop them to be able to come into contact. The second thing I'll say to that is we know across the country and across the world even, places where there's less inequality, places where there's a more egalitarian society, there's less harm and less crime. So you don't have to worry about someone breaking into your house because there's no reason for someone to break into your house and take from you because they're not doing it out of economic desperation.
What does it feel like after all the years that you spent thinking about this to see it really discussed on a national level in mainstream circles among people who'd never talked about this before?
Yeah, I think this is an incredible opportunity. You know, after law school, I went and worked on the Ferguson consent decree, and I went back home. I'm from St. Louis, is where I am now. And I worked on that consent decree with community organizers who thought the best that they could initially get was just body cameras, right? Even though there's no evidence that body cameras stop police from being violent. That's the best that we were hoping for. And then for 5 years later, for them to be imagining, we don't have to call police because people are outside who are loitering. We can instead use that money to create a jobs program, to offer employment instead. I think that shift in 5 years is remarkable.
That's lawyer and community organizer Derica Purnell in St. Louis. Thank you for talking with us.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Alex Vitale has been thinking about this, too. He recently wrote a book called The End of Policing. And so I asked him what specifically it would mean to defund the police.
Often these conversations tend to center around things like reducing our reliance on policing in schools, getting police out of the mental health business, quit using police to manage homelessness and start actually trying to put people in housing. The goal here is to both reduce the number of crises before they happen and also to create an infrastructure that allows clinicians to respond to these crises rather than armed police.
What about violent crimes, rape, murders? Police obviously don't have a sterling track record on solving those cases, but they do seem to be important to voters. What do you tell people about who's going to respond to and handle those kinds of offenses?
We have community-based anti-violence initiatives that have shown real success in reducing homicides and shootings without relying on mass incarcerations. They only solve about half of homicides. The majority of sexual assaults are never even reported to the police. And this is only after the harms have already occurred. We need to take as many steps as we can come up with to try to prevent these harms from happening in the first place. And as we do that, we can dial back our reliance on policing. It's not about just, you know, getting rid of all police tomorrow and you're on your own.
In your vision of the future, is there a police force at all? And if so, what does it look like?
Well, I think we don't know exactly the answer to that question. I think this is about a process of looking concretely at what police do and trying to find alternatives that don't rely on violence as the mechanism for producing safety. When we look at wealthy suburban communities, we don't see police on every street corner managing the problems of those communities. Those people are able to manage their own affairs for the most part because they have resources and they have stability in their lives. If their children have a drug problem, they don't want the police to get involved. They want to get high quality drug treatment or mental health counseling to deal with the reasons that addiction has become a problem in their lives. Well, why can't we have that for all communities to create that stability so that policing doesn't present itself as the only possible option?
That's Alex Vitale, professor of sociology at Brooklyn College and author of the book, The End of Policing. Thank you for talking with us.
My pleasure.
White supremacy is the sickness.
To Louisville, Kentucky, where Breonna Taylor lived. She was the black woman shot and killed by officers entering her apartment with a no-knock warrant. Last Friday, she would have turned 27 years old. No charges have been brought against the three officers involved in the killing. Now the Louisville Metro Police Department has released the incident report from the night of her death, and it contains very little information. Amina Elahi of member station WFPL is in Louisville and joins us now. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
There's a big difference between what we know about this shooting and what the incident report actually says about the shooting. What does the incident report say?
Well, the incident report doesn't really say very much. It was a four-page form, but really it could have just fit onto one page because of how little information it had. All it really said was that there is a death investigation, and it listed the names of the officers who shot Breonna Taylor, as well as some of her demographic details. But what it doesn't tell us is what really happened that night. It also had some strange things that were clearly inaccurate. For example, in the box where they would have listed injuries, all the report says is none. But we know that Taylor was shot eight times. And here's why people were so interested in this report. They thought or hoped that it might give more information, clarify what happened that night, because so little has come to light so far. But not only does it not even explain what did happen that night, it does very little to offer additional context. So that's why it's caused so much controversy here in Louisville.
Doesn't it also say there was no forced entry when, in fact, they broke down her door? I mean, how unusual is it for the police to give so little information, especially about such a high-profile case?
That's a good question, and we don't know because the police department hasn't answered questions about that. We asked, and the department hasn't explained, if this report was unusual in any way or if this is typically how the incident reports get produced. They did tell the newspaper here in Louisville that the errors were caused by making a paper copy from their reporting software. But we should remember, this shooting happened almost 3 months ago to the day. You'd think there'd be enough time to have fleshed this document out to explain what did happen in a factual way. And that's especially because every news outlet in town has been asking for it for weeks.
Yeah, and when I was in Louisville last week, everybody in the city, it seemed, was crying for accountability. Now that this nearly blank report has come out, what are people saying?
Well, people are really upset, especially those who are calling for action. In fact, just this morning, a local Black activist said that the report was a slap in the face to Black women. And Taylor's family and others who have been protesting for 2 weeks now against police violence, they're calling for action, they're calling for change, but they're not getting that. And now they're not even getting the basic information. So the police department has been both slow to release information and limited in what it does release. So that's been a major cause of frustration. The mayor yesterday said that this incident report is unacceptable. And today, one council member said that this is why the Louisville police need strong civilian oversight. He's part of a group that's working on an independent review board to instill some sort of accountability in police shootings. And that came about after the initial national outcry over the shooting of Breonna Taylor.
With such an outcry from civilians and city leaders, what are you hearing from police?
Well, the police still aren't saying very much. What they've told us is that there are continuing active internal investigations into both the Taylor case and another recent shooting of a man named David McAtee. So we continue asking for information. They continue telling us that the investigations are ongoing, and as a result, they can't give us more than the limited amount they've already provided.
That's Amina Elahi with member station WFPL in Louisville. Thank you for your reporting.
Thank you very much.
60 miles away, they had had the Tulsa riots years before I was born. But they never talked about them.
Never?
Slaughter. It was a slaughter. They never talked about it. Old folks never talked about when I was in Oklahoma.
Wow.
I heard a rumor about it. I didn't know what to think.
President Trump doesn't really have a choice. The country is opening its eyes to racial injustice in a new way. Both parties in Congress say it's time to do something about unjust policing. So President Trump needs to say and do something of his own.
At an event in Dallas yesterday, he said it's only a few police officers who are causing the problems, and he proposed not defunding police departments, but investing more in them.
We're working to finalize an executive order that will encourage police departments nationwide to meet the most current professional standards of force And that means force, but force with compassion. But if you're going to have to really do a job, if somebody's really bad, you're going to have to do it with real strength, real power.
Okay, so what does that mean in terms of actual policy?
We're going to ask White House correspondent Tamara Keith, who's with us now. Hi, Tam.
Good morning.
Tell us more about the president's plans.
So there's not a lot of detail here. It's mostly broad brush goals like reducing racial disparities in healthcare and offering school choice. On policing, we know that Republicans in Congress are still working out their policy response to what House Democrats have proposed. And it's not clear yet whether President Trump will endorse what the Republicans come up with. But he has made it clear that he does not think that there is a problem with systemic racism in police departments. And on racial problems more broadly in America, he said you can't heal the country by calling millions of people racist. He worked to draw a distinction between his support for police and activist calls for major overhauls of police departments. And he said that he's finalizing an executive order to encourage professional standards. But until we see it, it's not really clear what that's calling for.
So here he was in Dallas in this church. I mean, there had been talk of him doing a big speech to try to unify the country on race. Was this that?
No, it was sort of a combination of a rally and a panel discussion. He spent a lot of time talking about Seattle and the ongoing protests there, condemning the mayor and the governor. He talked about how the National Guard contained protests last week. He said it was like a knife cutting butter, even if some tear gas was required, he said. And he said that the Seattle protests would be so easy to solve.
So, I mean, this is him back on the campaign trail, right? I mean, this is, he's getting ready to start ramping things up. He's going to have his first big rally a week from today in Tulsa, the first big rally since the pandemic. The Tulsa location and date are significant. Can you explain?
There are a few reasons. First of all, it lands on Juneteenth, which is a holiday that marks the anniversary of the day the last slaves in America were finally told they were free. In African-American communities, it's a big day of celebration and food and music. But in Tulsa this year, organizers had to cancel their Juneteenth celebration because of coronavirus concerns. The organizer of that celebration told me President Trump's decision to hold a rally that day is untimely and disrespectful. There's another reason that people are raising concerns. The rally will be held just blocks away from the site of a 1921 massacre of black Tulsa residents by white mobs. And then there's the coronavirus. The rally is set to be held in a big indoor arena that holds thousands of people. And there are still concerns about large crowds during this coronavirus pandemic. In fact, there is a disclaimer for people when they go to get tickets for the rally saying that they won't hold the campaign or the venue responsible for any coronavirus exposure at the rally.
The man race, class, genre. And the dilemmas of black manhood.
Hanging. Usually people hang themselves in the privacy of their own homes.
Outrage and unanswered questions in Palmdale today after a man's body was found hanging from a tree. The coroner has ruled the death a suicide.
But his family and protesters are challenging that ruling. NBC4's Gordon Tokumatsu spoke with them.
In the crowd this afternoon, marching along with dozens of protesters, members of Robert Fuller's family, first cousins Pernicia, Deborah, and Robert, stopping briefly to speak with us about the young man who died and why they're demanding further investigation.
We're at a family function.
Pernicia says she was the last to see him in person. She describes her cousin as funny, well-mannered, with a mild personality. Another cousin, Robert Boyer, says Fuller would never have taken his own life.
No, because it wasn't a suicide.
But this afternoon, sheriff's officials and the coroner's office reiterated what an autopsy today, they say, revealed. Fuller hanged himself from a tree in the middle of Ponticlan Square. Someone found him there early Wednesday morning.
Although the investigation is ongoing, it appears that Mr. Fuller has tragically died by suicide.
Does that seem completely out of character for your cousin?
Yes.
Why?
Because he didn't seem... He was loving, and he was a happy kid.
We asked Fuller's cousins if there was a suicide note or any indication he was despondent.
Oh, did he post anything on social media to that effect?
Tonight, the investigation remains open. Homicide detectives say there are still leads to follow. In fact, they've even asked for the public to help them.
Recent travels and where he's been staying, we encourage you to call our homicide bureaus.
But protesters say the explanations are not enough, especially in light of recent events and civil unrest. Many told us they simply don't trust what law enforcement is saying anymore.
And we need answers, and we're not going to stop until we get answers.
In Palmdale, Gordon Tokumatsu, NBC4 News.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, June 13, 2020, so I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in. If you have thoughts, observations, questions to share, the number 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Woo, wowie. Lots and lots to discuss. My goodness. Let's see. All right. I'm trying to go through and get things taken care of for upcoming broadcasts as well. Woo. Man, oh man. What a week. They all are pretty tough, but wow. What a week. Hope folks are doing as best they can, taking quality care of yourselves. Was saying that earlier. We said that at the retreat back in Virginia. Self-care, act of black self-respect, that is the protest, I think, especially in these times. As dangerous as the system of white supremacy is, this seems like an acutely dangerous period. Self-care. Doing things to keep yourself safe, getting quality rest, eating nutritious, life-sustaining foods, drinking lots of water, maybe taking some time away from the television or scrolling on your phone or tablet or whatever it is to see all the latest updates about bad things that are happening, probably to black people. Take some time away from that. Self-care. That is a revolutionary act under current conditions. Lots to get to before we speak with listeners. Wow, just what a week. What a week. Let's see. First few things to share. We had a listener who wrote in. He wanted to share about his experience as we're doing a little bit of time as during jury duty time. There we go. Struggling jury duty time. Thought it was important because number one, this comes up so frequently in terms of victims of racism being deliberately excluded from juries. Right? This has gone all the way to the Supreme Court and prosecutors doing things deliberately to make sure that they can get all white juries, so it'll be easy for them to get convictions of black defendants. And so he got time, jury duty. He wrote in about his experience, racism, white supremacy. Let's see. It's taking some time. Why is that? I thought I had it loaded on the screen, but now it's taking a while to load. All right. While it's taking a while to load up, we'll get to other comments to share, and then hopefully the email will be working. That's so odd. Thought it was there, and then it's still acting odd. Sorry. While it's still taking its time to figure it all out. I wanted to emphasize, it should be obvious from the amount of news reports. I think I said it on the broadcast yesterday. Spring 2020 is basically done. We're almost in the summertime. Days away. June 2020 is half done. June is like my favorite month. I always love summertime. It's great. Any age, June is a great month, I think. Wow. This has not been the most fun June at all. Not by any stretch. Has not been the most fun year. Certainly has not been the most enjoyable June. And in fact, it hasn't even been June-like weather here in Seattle. I'm not sure if it got above 60 degrees today. It certainly didn't get above 61. It's been rainy a lot, overcast a lot. It hasn't even felt like summer very much for the first few weeks here. But in addition to spring is basically over, June is half over, 2020 is half over. Despicable as it has been, it is half over, which is kind of... It was not something that I rejoiced about, like, wow, the year is half over. It seems like it just started, and I guess by the time you spent half of the year in quarantine, can seem like, wow, where did the year go? But we are about half done with the year. So with that, I started looking back and thinking of trends, like, you know, what has stood out over the past 6 months, and I said, wow, armed whites in public. That is a major trend for this calendar year, and for lots of different reasons, like armed whites in public because they're mad about the lockdown, armed whites in public because they don't believe that there's such a thing as the Rona, armed whites in public because they are afraid of looters, armed whites in public because they want to mock the protesters, like lots of reasons. Armed whites because I want to protect my toilet paper. Like, it's been incredible. And they've been sent, like, March when the virus started. Rise in gun sales, ammunition, they started talking about all of that. It's just been all year long to where now everywhere, here in Washington State and other places, it's commonplace to see armed whites out in public for, as I said, a myriad of reasons. That in and of itself, if we have a system of racism, white supremacy, to have an environment where it seems like there are more white people out carrying, concealed carrying, to have an increase in that sort of behavior, that does not seem like an improvement for victims of racism, black people especially. And my president, 4 more years, he tweeted out, leftists, and I don't know what he meant by leftists, but he said leftists, they're trying to take your police and your guns. Welsing moment, I thought. Trying to take your police and your guns, the president said. I know what that sort of, the great equalizer, I think that was what Dr. Welsing said. I know how that sort of message resonates. More gun sales. It was a Cal's listener. Said, just paying attention to what's happening in the area. Said, folks on the job, what were they saying? Oh, man, got to get to the gun store. Got to get a few more rounds. Wish I could have got more. Big line at the gun store. Oh, man, I need to rack up. It's crazy out there. We got the boogaloo. That is 2020. That is another reason. Self-care, very dangerous times, worldwide really, but particularly here in the U.S., as they call it, very dangerous times. Take it seriously, and particularly take it seriously with regards to white people. When you're out and about in public, a black male got shot here in Seattle, Washington last week. He was I'm not sure if he's white. I don't know his racial classification, so my apologies. I don't know his racial classification. I haven't seen him. They should have a trial later on, so I will pay attention. I'll see if they have video, pictures, all that to determine racial classification. But the suspect, the gunman in the shooting could have been white. Regardless, he was armed. Firearm. That's why I said, like, it, particularly now, but really any time in the system of racism when we're out and about, we cannot be having altercations or talking to white people and just thinking that they're just going to use words. I wouldn't care if you're talking to a white man, white woman, white child, you have lots and lots of armed race soldiers, many of them without a badge. That is something to be mindful of at all times, rest of the year. Continuing. In the vein of self-care, man, it has been a doozy 2020 for so many reasons this week as well. But self-care, I have been posting, attempting to post photographs of some of the plant-based meals that I've consumed over the quarantine and different things I've done with my Vitamix over the few weeks that I've had that, and even before, just to encourage healthy eating, hoping folks, while we're trying to figure our way through all the chaos and confusion of this year, hoping that folks are not, you know, being at home, if you, you know, had to stay away from work or that sort of thing, or were working at home and just, you know, had to spend a lot of time in the house, hoping that folks are eating well, and not just being there and being stressed and eating, you know, sweets and potato chips and things like that. I think they, one of the phrases I've been seeing, they call it the Rona 10, people gaining 10 pounds or more sometimes, sitting through all this. I hope that is not Cal's listeners. We've been getting some water in and still getting some exercise time and eating correctly, but self-care, self-care, that is a revolutionary act, and really that is the guiding spirit behind the Cal's Counter-Racist Yoga Retreats. We've done two thus far. Rona forced us to cancel Toronto, taking that tough still, but working through it. The material has been updated on the blog for Washington, D.C. I will send it out to all the folks who emailed. I wanted to make sure I had that updated first. But the date's the same, August 5 through the 9th, Washington, D.C. Price, $680 total. Deposit of $400 due June 22nd. The remaining $280 due July 22nd. The information is posted on the blog. I'll make sure to send it out to everyone. See if we have folks that are still down to come hang out, do some yoga, plant-based meals, counter-racist workshops. As I say on the blog, the original plan, we were going to see if we could go to the Library of Congress, check out the Rosa Parks exhibit, see if we could go to the Smithsonian's exhibit on African-American history, but who knows what will be available, so we'll just have to wait and see, as they say. But the yoga, plant-based meals, counter-racist workshops, that should be doable, as long as we can travel and protests don't shut down the city. Drop an email if you would like more information. Just excited about the opportunity. I know for some folks, myself included, might be the first time that we get to do go out and do any significant travel or anything since all of this has started. Much less to hang out with some other victims and try to have some constructive time and energy, constructive dialogue and healthy vittles, and really to emphasize, you know, healthy eating. Like, you know, man, they've been saying with COVID-19 and even before that, we could do better with eating, do better with food. Like, man, let's really try and encourage that. If I can encourage that by showing it does not have to be something that takes gourmet chef skills, it can be really easy to enjoy fruits, veggies, beans, and have really tasty meals on a regular basis that are healthy, nutritious, and supporting your body. I was saying that we're going to need a lot of vitality to solve this problem, in thinking of that way, that I am eating to nourish my body so that I can carry out my cosmic assignment. That's the way Dr. Wellesen wrote it in the ISIS papers, cosmic assignment. Thinking that's the way that we're eating every time we sit down for a meal. August 5 through the 9th, Counter-Racist Yoga Retreat. Looking forward to having fun, healthy time, nation's capital, Rona permitting. Let's see. Next on the list, let me see if I can read the report. Jury duty. What happened at jury duty this week? Let's see if we have the information now. All righty, let's see if the page is working or is it still not cooperating. It still might not be cooperating. I'll save it and read it later in the broadcast then. I will make sure to get in my few notes quickly and then we'll get to the folks who dialed in. Quick notes from some of the audio clips from this week. They talked about Chicago and the looting. Wow. That was painful. painful because it sounded exactly like what Mr. Fuller said about in 68 in terms of what happened and who was damaged, who ended up being harmed most. Sounded like individuals who would be classified as black, not having a place to go get groceries. They said exactly what Mr. Fuller said, right? Like, didn't have a car, and where are we going to get, you know, basics, milk, toilet? They said it exactly. I even paused because they mentioned, they said, we were going to the Family Dollar. And I guess that got looted or burned or whatever. And they said Walmart, they don't know if they're going to come back. But when they mentioned the specific food, they said, this is where we go to get our basic groceries. He said, hot dogs, cereal, bread. I said, wow. That right there, counter-racist yoga retreat, like that can, or I won't say it can't, because that used to be a part of my staple diet, hot dogs, cereal, bread. I don't have any of those items in my residence. Don't know when the last time. I guess I've baked bread. I have baked bread more recently than I have purchased bread. How about that? But hot, I mean, what? Nonsense. I'm not critiquing him. I'm just saying that's the system of white supremacy. They just stuff us with nonsense. Nutricide. They just stuff us with nonsense. And he didn't say that they burnt down the Whole Foods that was on the corner. That's not what he said. He didn't say that they burnt down where the farmer's market is with all the organic produce. That's not what they said. They mentioned Walmart and the Family Dollar. Those are not places that I shop. Maybe they don't have a lot of Family Dollars here. They got Walmart, though. But, I mean, yeah, that is so many layers. We talked about that with packing them in terms of where we're going to be shopping at and why you would have health problems if that's what you've grown up in polluted Chicago next to Bubbly Creek eating Family Dollar hot dogs and cereal and bread. Yeah, you probably are not going to have the strongest immune system. Probably are not going to have a lot of vitality. Let's see. They just had a report on WBEZ, Chicago Public Radio, where they invested. They talked about how they, white people, have invested more money in one white neighborhood in Chicago than all of the black neighborhoods in Chicago combined. System of racism, white supremacy that white people are not ignorant about, talking about Walmart and these places. They said it's so hard to get white people to invest here, and they're not going to reinvest. Like, oh, the Negroes, they burned it all down. We don't want to put up with all that. Forget it. Ah. Right. Let's see. The food deserts got more deserted. What a metaphor. The food deserts got more deserted. Let's see. When they talked about the Boogaloo groups and the white nationalists that are coming in to take advantage, use this as a recruiting opportunity, they didn't mention Clavin Bundy by name. They just said that they went out to the desert to defend a Nevada rancher. I thought there was something incorrect about that. Why not just mention Clavin Bundy? He and his relatives are still prominently in the news. Ammon Bundy, right below me in Oregon, was talking about defying government orders and, you know, providing armed support to people who felt they were being oppressed by the government lockdown. Why not just go ahead and mention him by name and what he learned about the Negro? That's what he said. But they kept saying, we're not going to let no good crisis go to waste in their recruitment techniques. And they said the same thing President Trump said. When they come for your guns. President Trump just tweeted that out. Dr. Welsing, all over this. Welsing moments. When they come for your guns. The great equalizer. Also thought it was significant. Them going out to try to do things to be helpful. Bringing food and what have you. To be helpful. If we assist these white people, they might be more receptive to our particular brand of white supremacy racism. That can be applied to counter-racism techniques as well. Whatever you do, you go helping other folks out and then share your information about counter-racism. Let's see. Last piece of info I get in. When they were talking about defunding the police, I think it's super important in all the conversation articles, reports that I've heard about defunding the police, none of them have mentioned private police that white people have. I played those reports, read those reports from 2015, 2016, where they were talking 5 years ago about how this was a growing sector, More and more individuals classified as white signing up for these programs across the nation where they can be private police, have a badge, have a gun, go out and do all of this as private citizens. They didn't mention that at all, and or hiring the now unemployed police, if they do defund these police departments, how they might, or not might, would probably be hired by a lot of wealthy to have their own little private militias. They left that out of all the conversations that I've heard thus far. That's one component that I think is really suspicious. The other component, just specifically from the segment that I played from NPR, they spoke with Dorica Purnell, non-white female victim of racism in Missouri. This is ostensibly about racism, right? That's what the protests have been about, right? That's what I didn't think this was LGBTQ issue. I haven't heard that this was trans people or intersex people that the police were jumping on and choking out. Maybe I'm misinformed. But she says verbatim, for example, oh, metaphor. Some idiot talks about the comparisons and metaphors that they give. That does happen, right? So she says, for example, if someone sexually assaults someone or if someone kills someone because they're homophobic, calling the police officer is not going to stop people from becoming homophobic, right? Now, wait a minute. They do this entire article. I went back and looked at the transcript. They did this entire report on defunding the police, talking with an activist in Ferguson, Missouri. No mention at all of the term racism. And instead, we bring in a metaphor. Well, let's give an example. So let's say someone gets killed because they are homophobic and they don't like the LGBTQ community. See, so we got a homophobe. Not in the area Michael Brown Jr. was killed. We're not going to say it was racism that they killed this person because they're racist. We're not going to say it was a white person who didn't like black. No. It was someone who was a homophobe. Watch out for those metaphors. And again, they get through all of that with no mention of racism. We can get homophobia in there a few times, but we can't say racism at all in a report that's talking about defunding police. Saw a number of those reports this week where it was Black Trans Lives Matter. No one does it better. So much happened, I didn't even get in. Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi and the kente cloth. They clowned so hard this week. My goodness. The number is 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. What a week. I will request for this broadcast specifically if we could not use metaphors, if we could be direct, specific about what it is we want to say, that would be appreciated. Race soldiers, they have done a phenomenal job. It was a lot of metaphors used this week. America on fire, in the dark. Let's see. The food, even that food deserts got more deserted. It was a lot of metaphors used this week in the sound clips. Normally the case when talking about racism. If we could be specific, that would be grand. Victims of racism, including Dorica Purnell. We have been exposed to this misconduct in terms of deceptive language for a long time. And so a lot of that we have been influenced, myself included. If we could be direct, specific with what we want to say, I will prompt about the metaphors. Much obliged. Thank you kindly. If we could also take about 5 minutes to share your thoughts, just to make sure everybody gets at least one turn to share. If you have additional questions, observations, if you could just wait until everyone has shared at least once, and then you can come back and share your additional thoughts or questions. If you could use your mute button also, if you know you're in a noisy environment, just mute yourself. When you're ready to speak, you can unmute, share your thoughts, and then mute again. If you need to come back on to share additional thoughts, then you can just unmute and come back. Just helps us to have to keep from competing with having a lot of unnecessary background noise. With that, I'll just say that segment on Breonna Taylor where they talked about the police department in Louisville, Kentucky, they released the information, or I guess they didn't release the information. They released a report, but it had no information. I thought it would have been more accurate, call things by their proper name. if this document is lacking information, we don't want to call it information. We want to say that it was misinformation. And in fact, misinformation would be better because they kept pointing out that the report had so many inaccuracies, saying that there was no use of force, that Ms. Taylor had no injuries, things that were flagrantly in error. That's not information. That's misinformation. And it might even be willful misleading, willful deception. I mean, but at minimum, that's not information. That's misinformation. In fact, that's where you can use the new in vogue term, fake news. We got some fake news here. Anywho, *61 if you have comments to share. Wow, what a week. What a week. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. You have comments to share. Proceed.
Can I be here?
Greetings, caller in New Jersey. Line should be open.
Hey, Gus. Millie Fuller was definitely on point. As the effects, the after effects of riots. I'm from Newark, New Jersey. 1968 riots. I was born in 1978, and they didn't start rebuilding Newark until maybe the 90s. I remember as a child, we had the high-rise projects, and these projects looked abandoned, but people were still living in there. So if you ever seen footage of the National Guard and state police and local police shooting into the project windows during the 1968 Newark, New Jersey riot. The damage of the riots lasted throughout the 70s and the 80s, well into the 90s when they started to tear down those housing projects and the area of Springfield Avenue, which was from my grandmother's recollection, were like a downtown area. There's a downtown Newark, and you can pretty much get anything that you wanted on Springfield Avenue. Springfield Avenue was destroyed, and Newark experienced white flight. So when I was growing up, there was no white people. Most white people that you encounter either was law enforcement, you know, some kind of government agency, or worked in the school system. So I think it's accurate. I was just looking at the news. There was another black male killed by a race soldier in Atlanta. I just seen, speaking of looting, he was killed in a Wendy's parking lot, and that Wendy's is set on fire. oh man, so, I've noticed a lot of back and forth with, other victims who are classified as conservative. I've seen a lot of back and forth on social media, as far as people, you know, calling them coons, and you know, but I've noticed my code, because it does accept, it does get me upset. Gus, callers, I'll be a liar if I say that watching the anti-blackness from some self-proclaimed black conservatives and how they basically use their platforms to disparagingly talk against black empowerment, or you know, just basically and repeat white talk, white conservative racist talking points. It angers me. So I just basically have a code where I find out who's supporting them, and I just basically go after them. So once they get to start talking, I go after the white people who basically fund them. In New York City, when I was at work, very interesting, as I give a court in closing. New York City looks like maybe if it was preparing for a hurricane. So if you go to Times Square, if you go to the Soho area and other parts of New York City, all the stores are boarded up. From the stores that was looted and stores that wasn't looted, there's just boarding. So it looks like they're preparing for a hurricane in New York City. Friday, as I'm riding in the Soho area of Manhattan, I just see lots and lots of white people. And they're painting on the boarded up stores. And they're allowed to. I don't think that they're the store owners, but, you know, they're painting Black Lives Matter. They're painting women, black women with their fists in the air. And as a victim, I must admit, I am totally confused. I don't know what to make of this. So, you know, so they're just, you know, so, I mean, is that going to solve the problem? Is that going to dismantle white supremacy? You know, white people in Manhattan painting Black Lives Matter and painting black power fists on boarded up Louis Vuitton and Gucci stores. I doubt if it does. I watched, I know Gus, not to give a shameless plug, but I watched the Dave Chappelle comedy, and it wasn't comedy. It was a victim speaking about racism. I think it was definitely something that I wouldn't mind recommending. So, you know, that's basically, you know, what I got right now. And I gave you a report of what I've seen, and day by day, I think, I'm becoming more confused, cause I really don't know what to make of, what I'm seeing. And I close with that.
Much obliged, victim in New Jersey. You're out there. That's where the, correctional officer was. The Trump supporters, they out were mocking the Black Lives Matter protesters and did their mock depiction of Mr. Floyd's murder. But what you just said, that right there lets me know that exactly what I said, man, race soldiers have clowned so hard this year. Like, wow. What I just said, Congressman Nancy Pelosi, she was out there with Senator Chuck Schumer. There's a whole bunch of them. They had their kente cloth on. They did the Colin Kaepernick take a knee. Like, we are with the Negro. We are a friend of the. You see my kente cloth? Let me get in the light here. You see this kente cloth? This is authentic. We sent over to the motherland to get the. Like, it was. They have clowned so hard. And if the result is we have black people confused, victims of racism confused. Dr. Welsing, the grandcestor, A+. And what you do exactly what you should do. When you get confused, you start asking questions. Let me see if I can get some understanding here. How is scrawling, really graffiti, how is writing graffiti on these walls, how is that going to solve any problems for black people? And you just wait till you get logical answers, because that's, hey, excellent question. They did the same. Matter of fact, here in Seattle, they have clowned so hard that the president is upset. Four more years. They clowned so hard here in Seattle, they wrote Black Lives Matter not on graffiti on the side of the walls. No, let me tell you what they did. They got a visual. They took up an entire city block and wrote Black Lives Matter in the middle of the road that takes up a whole block. Like, you need to have like a helicopter aerial view to even be able to see, like, oh, okay, it's Black Lives Matter. Like, written out that large. In the middle of Capitol Hill, which is the LGBTQI epicenter of Seattle. In fact, if there was the Gay Pride Parade was supposed to be, I think within the next couple of days, it would have been right there where they were scrawled Black Lives Matter. Clown so hard. Let's see. Seattle looks like a war zone as well. And with the graffiti. looks like a war zone. I finally got the email to do correctly, so I'll read it now in case it gets lost. Jury duty. Non-white black juror's story. Greetings, Gus. I thought I would share my experience as a juror on a criminal trial in Los Angeles County. My code for being a victim of racism, white supremacy, serving as a juror. Consider the information presented within the court, knowing the system of racism, white supremacy is at work, especially in a court of law. The first thing I always do when summoned for jury duty, check the room for other non-white black males. On the first day, I may have seen four other non-white black males, to be expected. I was summoned along with about 75 other people to a courtroom. I was the only non-white black male in the entire pool of 75. It was a criminal trial. A non-white black male was facing 25 years to life in prison. Woo! Wow. For grand theft armed robbery. His alleged accomplice, pregnant girlfriend, was also facing the charge of robbery. Each were assigned their own attorney. Both were appointed by the court. A non-white black female represented the male. A white male represented the female. To my surprise, I was called into the jury box of 14, 12 jurors and two alternate jurors. You are asked by the judge a series of basic questions. Name, occupation. Do you know someone or have you been a victim of a crime? And whether you knew anyone in law enforcement. I know a lot of people in law enforcement, including my spouse, niece, and people I have known since childhood. Regarding the question of a crime, I thought to myself, I see a crime every day, and I'm probably seeing one right now. True. I made it through the selection process and learned after the trial, the white male defense attorney wanted me removed, but the non-white black female defense attorney fought to keep me. How interesting. I just said that. That went all the way to the Supreme Court. White male prosecuting attorneys, mostly, some of them down in Georgia, working vigorously to make sure we don't have any niggers in the jury box. Continuing, the white male prosecutor presented his case to show the defendant used a gun to rob a woman of a county general relief credit card. The prosecutor's lone witness to the crime was not credible to all 12 jurors. The body cam footage presented had the suspected race soldier hand in front of the lens, and we, the jurors, could not see anything to support the alleged crime. In addition, the judge ruled the audio to body cam would not be allowed. The defendant resided in a single-room occupancy, SRO, on Skid Row with his pregnant girlfriend. If you are not familiar with an SRO, it is literally one room. No kitchen. No bathroom. The building has a community bathroom, COVID-19. The prosecutor allowed two suspected race soldiers to be witnesses. It was very clear to everyone they both lied. An interesting statement made by the rookie suspected race soldier in my experience as a police officer, I thought, experience? You just got there. What could you have experienced in the short time on the job to be able to utter that statement? Unless it is rehearsed. The prosecutor did not enter the video from the SRO. The defense attorney obtained and presented the video. The video showed the defendant and alleged victim enter a bathroom where the defendant entered the bathroom first and was followed by the alleged victim to smoke crack. The defendant testified he went to his room with his pregnant girlfriend, was sleeping to smoke crack with the alleged victim. When the pregnant girlfriend woke up and saw them smoking, she chases both of them out, supported by the video. The video shows them, defendant and alleged victim, leaving the room and building. After they left the room, the pregnant girlfriend stole the county card. If she had not testified, we would have not found her guilty. Wow. As I sat there, knowing the defendants were not guilty based on the presentation of the prosecutor, I thought, what did this guy do to the police? Why are the police going after him so hard? Then I thought, wait, it's not the police. The DA is the one to decide whether a case is worth a grand jury first, and then whether it is worth their time and energy to take the case to trial. Then I thought it was the judge who decided the jurors could not hear the audio. The system of racism, white supremacy. Turns out the gun was a paintball gun. The prosecutor wanted the jurors to believe without any supporting evidence the county general relief card had a balance of $1,000. I had a friend on general relief, so I knew the most may be $300. The prosecutor needed the $1,000 value to apply to crime of grand, otherwise it would have been a petty theft. I probably wouldn't have been able to go for 25 years if it was petty theft. I'm not a lawyer. When we went to deliberate, the jurors started asking which evidence should we ask for to be reviewed during our deliberations. I said, who here believes the defendant is guilty of the crimes he was accused? No one thought he was guilty. I asked, then why do we need to review anything if you don't believe he is guilty? Look at that. Ask two questions. Let's see. We proceeded to deliberate the pregnant girlfriend. The pregnant girlfriend's attorney, white male, allowed her to testify, and we all agreed her testimony wasn't needed after hearing the prosecutor's case. I stayed after the jurors were released to ask the non-white black female defense attorney, why did you allow him to testify? She said, I thought we needed his testimony. I asked, did you not hear the prosecutor's case? That is when I clued in the defense attorney was working to send this man to jail too. Incompetent representation. Mumia Abu-Jamal talks about that quite a bit, getting attorneys that are not, it's not like you're getting Johnny Cochran every time, you know, the late, great. Talked about him Mumia Abu-Jamal too, but it's not like you're going to get Johnny Cochran every time. Talked about it? Yeah, anyway, Johnny Cochran, the late, great. Not like you're going to get him. They said they both had court-appointed attorneys. So, yeah, much obliged for sharing. Racism, white supremacy is on display all the time. That is amazing that you even got on the jury, because they do work pretty aggressively, not only just to stuff a lot of black people in greater confinement, but also to make sure that a lot of black people do not get on juries. So, wow, good job getting on, and kudos for sharing the report. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Hello.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Hope everyone's having the best evening they can. Thank you for that jury report. That was very interesting. I remember, in fact, I think it was over a decade ago, I was on a board with someone who was the defense attorney, what worked for the defendant's office in Ohio, Dayton, Ohio, because that's where I used to live. And he said that it wasn't the goal to help the defendants, like, be acquitted. It was like to help move the system or something. And I always thought that was weird, and I guess that's confirmation, because the person said that the goal was not to help the black defendant be acquitted. So that's that. Again, other interesting clips. And I just had a question. I don't know if people might think about this. They always use that term cancel culture, and it seems like when when a cancellation is requested, I don't know what the term to call it, when a cancellation is requested because of an offense to black people, they always say, has it gone too far? I wonder if anyone has noticed that. I noticed if it's for women, I get Me Too, they only went too far when they started attacking white men. And never had they tried to, I guess, cancel Kevin Hart for some homophobic remarks, but his movie did well, so the white people are like, well, we need to keep him around, I guess, because he's making money for us. But it wasn't too far, you know, to cancel him. And I just wanted to know, because I've been thinking about that for a while, because every time I hear cancel culture towards canceling something that hurts black people, it's always does it go too far. Thank you.
Much obliged. I have heard that pretty frequently when they talk about, you know, wait a minute, do we need to banish everybody? And, you know, do we need to toss them out the way we did Donald Sterling? And Paula Deen, I've heard that for quite some time. Bill Maher, I think, is one who's very prominent with that sort of view. Like, oh, no, we don't want to just banish somebody because they said something. Like, very, very common. I've heard that they'll do it for younger people, too. I've heard it if they do something on social media. Like, oh, they'll even have a lot of victims sometimes. They'll give them a platform to come out and say, oh, yeah, I don't think this. I think the black male, Mr. Cooper, in New York, where he was out bird watching, and the white woman, I think she lost her job. I think he said the same thing, like he didn't want all that to happen, just wanted her to learn and reflect. Very common. Other folks dialed in, if we have missed you totally. If you have commentary to share, proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am. If you could speak up a tad, that would be helpful. A little bit more volume.
Okay. Let me adjust. Can you hear me better now?
Yes, ma'am. Improvement. Yes, ma'am.
Okay. All right. So I wanted to give some commentary. This is caller from Colorado. I'm a highly traumatized victim of white supremacy. This week has been really, really rough personally, and then just seeing everything in the media. Yes, I was married to a white supremacist, recently divorced. It's been about a year has passed. And that was a traumatizing experience because this person was a doctor. And so kind of went into the marriage naively, believing it was one thing, and then finding out over time that I was married to a rabid white supremacist. So when Gus was like mentioning like the guns, white men armed in society, it's really triggering because this is the person who used to stockpile, and so I would see guns and ammo all the time in the house. But just at work, you know, now that I'm back into the workforce and I, you know, my degree is in healthcare, just kind of listening to other white men, some are ex-military who work in the hospital, you know, kind of making offhanded comments to other healthcare providers how, you know, as soon as they get off work, they're going to head to Cabela's to get more guns or to get more ammo, and how a lot of the ammo in these gun stores is sold out. And so that's been like a huge angst amongst a lot of white men. So that's really triggering. And it reminds me of Dr. Welding, when she talked about Nazi Germany and kind of like the that kind of first wave of the propaganda, and how it was a critical time when there was too much mixing. So when the Jews and the whites had reached a critical mass of mixing, that's when kind of all hell broke loose. And I feel like that's what's happening in America, is that there is so much mixing now. There's an agitation happening. And so what that last caller was talking about, he's confused about why are white, you know, people writing Black Lives Matter on these boards. You know, these are so-called left-leaning white people who are trying to advocate right-leaning white people, in my opinion. So there's a convergence happening, and that's what's so frightening, is that it seems like the left and the right are converging in a very strategic way to kind of lead to this pre-Nazi Germany atmosphere. That's just what it feels like to me. The journalism clip I found interesting. The other field other than healthcare that I was interested in was journalism, and so to kind of hear how the black woman was, you know, basically ostracized in the newspaper, and the white guy who wrote something far worse is, you know, still allowed to, you know, write his editorials. White supremacy. There is, you know, another comment I wanted to make about, you know, a comment that was made to me at work. It was actually yesterday at work. A non-white Mexican nurse made a comment to me about how I would carry myself in the hospital. And, you know, I came into the OR to kind of, I have to do some things to the room to get ready for the next surgery. And, you know, the patient is basically knocked out. The anesthesiologist is in there. The charge nurse, this Mexican guy, a couple of other techs are in there. And when I enter the room, the charge nurse is all, says to everybody, there's like six people in the room, oh, here she comes. She's entering. She walks like she's the boss. She walks like she's the CEO of the company. She's really a man. They've got her dressed up like a woman. You guys better watch out for her. And, I mean, I'm soft-spoken. I didn't know how to respond to it, so I didn't want to respond to it. But he strikes me as a very, he's trying hard to be white, in a sense. He is a very Americanized, kind of Mexican man. And so that was really hurtful, and it was something that I've been processing how to respond to. I do think in the future probably just need to get my mouth shut, but it is at a point where it's causing me embarrassment, causing me to lose black self-respect. I do feel like I need to speak up, especially since this job isn't necessarily my bread and butter. It's a different experience, but it's not what's sustaining me. And so that was just, you know, something that has affected my weekend. You know, it happened yesterday, and I'm still thinking about it today, and I just want to enjoy my weekend, which is hard to do in the system, but... that's my
sense, about the speech. Much obliged, caller in Colorado. Neutralizing Workplace Racism, Fridays, 8 p.m. Eastern. Let's see, 6 p.m. Mountain Time, 5 p.m. Pacific. Well, at least in my view, that's sort of when people are intimidated. Dr. Welsing talked about that on a regular basis, because we've had a lot of folks as well who've called in talking about that, being in a workplace situation, and if you are intelligent, attractive, might be both, my goodness, and race soldiers is just, oh my gosh, like, I can't believe it. Like, what? This coon knows more than I do. You know, and they're young and fit and attractive, and I'm, you know, frumpy, and I eat chicken nuggets all day. Like, ugh, you know, like, in particular, you said, with some of the details with this one, like, this is, I think you said, a Mexican non-white person who is white identified. Seems like they want to be accepted as white. They want to be a race soldier. And a lot of times, the way that you prove that, mistreat some black people. I'm going to show them that I have disdain. So I'll find different ways where I can make little snide remarks and that sort of thing. I think expecting that, I think once you grasp that, one thing that we can work on in terms of our composure so that it has less of an impact on us with, you know, knowing that we're going into an environment where people are going to be saying these sort of things. And also I would try to give as little of response as possible. Like, I'm not going back and forth and how dare you and blah blah blah, and you walk in here like you own the place. Might not say anything. That might be one where you give them the classic Mr. Fuller. Leave it at that and go on about the rest of my day. Might give them, if I have to say anything, make it a shorter, walking in here like you own the place. And who do you think? Well, can have dreams. That's what they say, right? Have dreams. But it wouldn't be a whole lot. Just be, I know these are not my friends, not my homies, not my pals, and I am certain they are intimidated. Even though I'm still a victim of racism, I understand that totally, but there is some, what they call it, envy. Understanding that totally. So, yeah, they can make their little snide remarks and all that. Duly noted. If other folks who are listening in, because we've heard this from a number of folks, this is not the first, this is not the fifth, not the sixth, especially the folks, you eat well, you're not doing fast food, you're not at Wendy's and all that, you eat well, take care of yourself, get your exercise in, some swimming, hiking, yoga, what have you, and you're on a job and you got these frumpy white women, and they're like, what in the world? I'm supposed to be the one that's attractive, and you're in here all curved and shaped up and everything and dressed nice and eating celery and vegetables every day, man, feeling uncomfortable, got something snide to say. We've had a whole lot of folks who said that. If you got a better code for how you nip that in the bud in a codified manner, feel free to share. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, commentator share, line should be open. Feel free.
Can I be up?
Greetings, Henry in Chicago. Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. Just share some of my observations, at least on the south side of Chicago, that was driving around. And I noticed that the stores, like Walmart, some of the Walmarts that are possibly not reopening, are in places where gentrification is basically is in place right now, and you know, probably ramping up more. So those Walmarts actually won't be missed, because most of the areas, especially non-white black areas, they have stores there, and like you mentioned, Whole Foods, you know, they're still open. There's a lot of Jewels that are still open. And there's one particular Walmart that, for some reason, the mayor of Chicago, Lori Lightfoot, was, I guess, you know, asking that Walmart to reopen. It's on 83rd Street. But what's so ironic about it is there's a Jewels that's still open that's less than a mile away. So, like I said, it's an area that's about to be gentrified. So they're going to be kicking all the, you know, black folks out anyway. Most of the food deserts in the black areas on the south side, they're still food deserts. Like the report said, you know, there might have been some dollar stores that got hit. Most of them I saw were reopened again. So obviously they want to continue to sell poison food to non-white black people. And what was also interesting was a tape was released, a security camera was released, a tape of a security camera within Congressman Bobby Rush's office. Apparently during the riots in Chicago, some race soldiers basically broke into his office and started helping themselves out to coffee. They caught one race soldier basically sleeping on the couch, all while the riots is going on. So there's a big, you know, uproar in that because the tape was released to the press. So, yes, these race soldiers basically broke into Congressman Bobby Rush, non-white black U.S. congressman, former, you know, Black Panther. But, yeah, they were in his office. Like I said, they didn't have any keys to his office, and Congressman Rush wasn't there. So they basically broke in and just lounged in the office while, you know, a lot of looting and destruction was going on in the nearby store where his office is at. So that's what the officers thought about stores in the areas where black people live at. So that's all I have right now, me and my line.
Wow. They broke in and took a nap. Who does that? Who breaks into a congressman or congresswoman's office? Just give me a little power nap, get a few winks, and brew coffee? I mean, and in the midst of all this, brewing coffee? Come on. That's odd, too. The footage would get leaked to the press like that. Strange times indeed. I feel like so late to the, or I feel so uninformed, getting information later than others. I saw today, is it accurate? Is Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot, is she in a tragic arrangement with a white woman? Is that accurate?
Yeah. Yes.
Maybe I forgot that. I don't know. I saw it and I was stunned. Like, whoa, did I know that? That seems new. Like, whoa. Yikes, okay. Yikes. Maybe she should run with Biden. I don't know if they're talking about maybe putting her on the ticket? Maybe that would be a good good match. Still going to be four more years. I'm just, you know, thinking out loud if they're trying to fix a winning combination, because this is not going to work anyway. They mix it up and try it. I'm just trying to I think that would be a better alternative than everything that I've heard. I would take her over Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms and some of the other names that I have heard, because they said he's got to get a black person. It seems like it's got to be a black female. So what could be better? She gets Chicago, so he's got the sneak Obama legacy. But yeah, four more years, doesn't matter. Same thing I said before. It is going to be an embarrassing or November embarrassment. That's the way I've been saying it. November embarrassment. And you talk about confusion. Man, after we've watched all these white people run around in the streets and Black Lives Matter and No Justice, No Peace and all the rest of it and Say Her Name, blah, 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 and all that, and we're in kente cloth, and then we get to November and four more years. Now, you talk about major confusion. Maybe I'll be wrong by then, though. Other folks, the number 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Other folks, we missed you totally. Proceed.
Yeah, greetings. Oh, you can go ahead, sir.
No.
Thank you, sir. This particular phrase was known with the Nation of Islam. But anyway, as far as studying history, it may help the caller who said that he is confused about the goings on. Historically, white people have shown some cordial instances with someone that they have defeated in the past, and in this case, with non-white black people who are born captives in this global prison. Basically, the only thing that they have been doing is repeating the phrases and the cliches, and they have a history of understanding that there is a percentage of non-white people who actually have an appreciative reaction when white people do such gestures. And all in all, in the end, nothing actually gets done, which is the desired effect that takes place. So maybe, sir, if you would, you know, in your studies, I hope you're able to come out of confusion, and you know, continue, you know, just keep studying, and you can figure it out. Just to report, I think I mentioned another former teammate / fellow student that was in ICU with pancreatic cancer and COVID-19. Well, he died earlier this week. So just a consistent warning with all the listeners is to stay alert with the different practice suggestions, because we as prisoners of war are going to be the last ones to get information. So be as conservative as possible with the different suggestions that are being made. You have this program, and the host have invited people who know a lot more about the situation than we do. I think it is worthy that we listen to such people. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Sorry to hear that, retired firefighter. Man, take it seriously. Take it seriously. Until we have much better information otherwise. Like, wow. Context of white supremacy. Much obliged, caller in Florida. Thank you for yielding for a retired firefighter if you wanted to proceed.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners, and callers. Myself as well. My condolences goes out to Mr. Retired Firefighter's good friend. I was just thinking about that as well, about how we should be taking that seriously with the COVID-19. And I just keep noticing that on the news reports, it's either the protests against racism and the COVID-19 cases, as they say, being on the rise. Here locally, there was a report of white people doing Black Lives Matter protests, giving out free masks and T-shirts. And there was a 15-year-old white person, suspected racist. They say he's been out, I think, in High Springs, I believe, all week long. And I'm like, I didn't even see any black people out there. So just definitely paying attention and noticing the different reports. And also, there was a student government person here at University of Florida that he made racist comments online, and another white person, I guess, was exposing it. All right, saying that he personally knew this person, and the post said he said the word nigger. Somebody pointed it out, and all you could see was him saying, oh, it isn't racist, it's conservative. All right, so nobody explained what that even meant. It isn't racist, it's conservative. So this other person that they was interviewing saying that he heard him say homophobic comments. So there it is again, the conflation, I think that what the term is when it comes to addressing the system of racism. And the term systematic racism is being more used. As far as the protests, definitely I can see how many victims are becoming confused, or it doesn't seem like there is an ability to, I guess, constructively process what is going on, just in many situations, in my opinion, because they already have, they sold a white person handing money to black males, white men handing money over to black males. And then them saying, like, oh, you know, the reason I was doing that is I needed them to get medical supplies. All right. So why would you give them money? See, I didn't believe the person, you know, it doesn't make any logical sense. It sounds like, I guess the term people use, agent provocateur or whatever, but I just think it's just racist deception being practiced. And I do think that I like that word as well. I've used that term, convergence, when you have white people who are so-called Antifa, or what they like to call liberals, Democrats, are being next to victims of racism in large groups, make it seem as though that they are in opposition to racism, all right? And then you have the other group of people who are called Republicans or, you know, whoever. That's usually the people that they like to be the main example of what a racist is. And I think both groups definitely work in unison to practice white supremacy. So when you have the kneeling with the kente cloth and all of that kind of thing, doing a different type of form of racism all at once, a synergy, that's another word, like a synergy, to produce the result of continued white supremacy. And it's definitely very important that we gain knowledge and understanding of how to counter and neutralize white supremacy. And that's all I have for now. Thanks for allowing me to share.
Much obliged, caller in Florida. Convergence. That is really important because they use that strategy so frequently. It is so powerful, right? In my view, number one, we go back to the question, what does it mean to be classified as white? Convergence, right? You have all these whites, or you have a situation where racism, white supremacy is being reported. You'll have black people, non-white people, they'll come out, they're upset or reporting racism. You'll have some white people that will come and join them. You have some white people that will come and shout against them. You'll have, you know, some other white people might come and shout against those white people. Convergence, or as he said, synergy, that would be another way. You have this combining of forces, but the end result, you know it's successful. Why it's so powerful? What does it mean to be white? You end up thinking that, oh, man, we got Donald Trump, these MAGAs, you know, once we get rid of them, Donald Sterling, once we get rid of them, Paula Deen, once we get rid of them, I'm with you, brother. You see my kente? I told you I got this from Ghana today. Look at that. Imported. See that? Got that in the middle of the Rona. Kente cloth, see? Confusion. Where you end up, oh, wow, we've got, looks like a lot of these folks who, you know, they might be classified as white, but they're not racist. I mean, hey, not all white people are racist. We got my white brothers and sisters right here. We've been out 5, 10, 20 days. We've been out in the streets right here in Seattle. We scrolled, I think we tagged at least 15 buildings with Black Lives Matter. So, I mean, I know Susie is not a racist. You don't go around tagging buildings 20 times and almost getting arrested and pepper sprayed if you are a racist. Or do you? The number is 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Confusion. Folks we missed totally, other folks who had a hand up that we have missed totally. Well, while folks are getting it together, we have about 15 minutes left.
Hello.
Oh, that was one person. Yes, ma'am.
I talked before, but no one said anything, so I wanted to know if it was okay.
Our caller, and proceed.
Okay. To the young lady, I think in the medical field, she was talking about how, you know, she's a female, and they called her a male. I wrote into the policy that could be gender harassment. I know they added new things to transgender. Not that you're transgender, I'm not trying to say that. But you, as a woman, trying to say present yourself as a man or something like that would actually be a problem. Because it's not supposed to be a problem in the workplace. You are who you are. You're supposed to accept everyone the way that they are. I would look into the policy to see if that was some form of gender harassment and ask about that. Thank you.
What I wanted to contribute, can I be heard?
Ma'am, same thing. If you could kind of speak up a little bit or maybe get closer to your receiver or maybe both. Just lots of volume, lots of black self-respect.
Okay, give me a second. Let me Okay, can you hear me better?
That is an improvement.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am. Improvement.
Okay. Yeah, I had it on my my earphones. I almost wonder, because I was born a female. I'm very much an attractive female. I used to model. I mean, I get a lot of attention, so I do feel like I'm a very beautiful woman. But what that did, I am a cognizant of white supremacy, and I was wondering, because when they were moving the body out, when they were moving the person who was who had just had surgery out, it's kind of a tight room, and the anesthesiologist also said, you know, you got to make yourself skinny, so I had to kind of move it against the wall so that they could move the body. And they made the joke right after the Mexican nurse had said what he said, we're just trying to orient you. And so me moving back was them helping. I mean, it was all in a joking fashion, but I almost wonder if these little snide comments is, you know, again, the system of white supremacy, is they see like a strong kind of self-respecting black person who carries themselves with their head up high, if they try to plant those subtle seeds of confusion. That was what was kind of replaying in my mind as well. It's like, I know, because I've been in the OR, you know, while they're doing these surgeries. And I mean, the way that these nurses and doctors talk to each other, it's so toxic. And I mean, they make foul jokes over the body. And it's really just an interesting dynamic. I mean, somebody should record just kind of the disgusting nature of what's happening during somebody's surgery. But I'm sure that when I'm not in the room, you know, I'm being talked about, other black people are being talked about. And so I just wonder if, you know, some of that is being discussed. And then when I come into the room after the operation, you know, that's their opportunity to make those types of guests. So that was just something I was playing around in my mind, especially when you guys were talking about the conflation of black people with homosexuality or homophobia. That I'm seeing that constant conflation of those two concepts, and I think that is very deliberate.
They did that with Michelle Obama as well. They would make comments that she's a male, and that was throughout their tenure in the White House. And I think that too is all about being intimidated. Dr. Welsing talked about that color envy in terms of a motivating factor for whites practicing racism. But totally, if being young, attractive, in shape, all of that, absolutely would be threatening. And intelligent, that would absolutely be threatening. Anything that they can say to undermine and have you. So we talk about that all the time with workplace racism. Chip away at that confidence, chip away at that black self-respect. So you're doubting yourself and get some insecurities. Like, we do not want any black self-respecting person in here feeling confident and competent about their abilities and how they look and how they're walking in the world. Who's the person that spoke up simultaneously?
Yes, that was me. Also, that was me, Gusta. You can go ahead.
Go ahead.
Okay. Gus, I just wanted to add on what the caller just talked about. And what she experienced on the workplace is what formed my code moving forward on the workplace. Just those subtle jokes, kind of homosexual jokes. When I was younger, those jokes eventually led up to racial jokes. But racial jokes to deliberately saying outright spook, saying outright nigger, you know, and, you know, so my code moving forward on any workplace, I do not joke. I'm not going to say I don't joke, but I don't joke. As far as like homosexual, if you want to joke about something on the workplace, like a box fell and we laugh, ha ha. But homosexual jokes, when we start talking about other ethnicities, my code has always been to nip it in the butt. You can do that with silence, or what I do is I kind of nip it. That might have been a metaphor, but I end it quickly.
And by ending it quickly means the first time a joke makes me feel uncomfortable, I address it right then and there. You know what I mean? So there's no mistaking, like, you know, Victor from New Jersey, he doesn't joke. You know, leave him alone. And I make sure that it gets around whatever workplace that I'm on. And real fast, just to talk about my confusion and the reason why I say I'm confused because this puts me in a strange position to explain racism to people that's more confused than me. So now I'm classified as the guy who thinks all white people are possibly racist. The friends who are more confused are now saying to me, caller from New Jersey, you possibly can't believe all white people are racist. You know, did you see the protests? Did you see all the white people? Mm-hmm. So now it just basically makes it hard to explain racism to people that's more confused than I.
Understood. I heard Thomas in New York. I would just say with that real quick, number one, again, that just shows a system of white supremacy, how effective racist man, racist woman, racist child have been in terms of confusion, you know, so that we really don't even when we're out protesting and talking about racism all day long and all the problems that it causes in all these areas of people activity, most victims still do not understand racism, white supremacy, and no one on this broadcast right now, myself included, no one is excluded from that. That's what Dr. Welsing used to talk about all the time. So that just shows you, you know, the magnitude of the problem. And with those sort of conversations, that is so consistent where it gets there. You know, are you saying that all white people are racist? That's racism. Don't you think it's extreme? Don't you see Heather Heyer out there in Virginia, John Brown, Timothy Wise? These folks are out with their placards. Yes, I see all of that. A lot of this would come back to what does it mean to be white? Is it possible that someone could be white, do all of those things, and still practice racism? Is it possible they could put down that placard and then go back to the business of supporting and practicing white supremacy racism? Has that happened before? These would just be questions that I might not even answer. It would just be something to think about and ponder. But even though it can be frustrating, it often is frustrating talking to other victims of racism, especially if they're very confused. And even if you are confused and you're talking to someone else about a subject matter in which you both are very confused, man, that can be extra frustrating. You all can argue and all that. It's never pleasant to be confused. But I would at least, if you're able to have courteous dialogue, and that's the thing, I would be majorly paying attention if it's courteous. And they are receptive, like they're asking questions and they are listening. They're not interrupting. They're not just waiting. Coon, you don't know what you're talking about. You don't have it together. Coon, shut up. Like, it's really. I'll have to. So this is why, you know, you're suspicious. Even the people that are out in the. I'll have to. If that's more of the vibration that you're getting, it is totally worth the investment to deal with it and field the questions and try to give the best responses that you can or provide resources. It's totally worth the investment as long as they're receptive and asking questions. Thomas in New York. Yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the callers. Caller in New Jersey, I remember the Avon and Prince Street projects in Newark. Boarded up. They were slated to be torn down. They removed all the black people. They didn't get them anywhere to go. So they went back to the projects and lived in the boarded up building for years before they eventually came up with a plan B for them. The media content being consumed during surgery, it was almost mind-boggling. It was very... It was mind-boggling. I would come in after they did a surgery, and then you look at the computers at what they were just listening to, and their radio, and, you know, they're in there listening to Death Leopard and Nirvana while they're cutting black people open. You know, just very interesting. And no need for blackface. the white people could just go put on dashikis. I don't understand why they need to put on the blackface. So, to me, that was what they did in Congress was the equivalent of blackface. It was terrible. I'm glad Cory Booker didn't do it. But I did see some blacks with it on, like, I think the narrative, the media is propaganda and it's untruthful and it's leading to confusion, very deceptive. Because I saw the violent protests, I saw people damaging property, saw people stealing and looting, and I saw the police do nothing to stop it. And mayors and governors refused to send in the National Guard for 2 days, 3 days. I mean, so the president threatened to send in the military. I think if I was the president, I probably would have did the same thing. Look in Seattle. I think they said they got 6 blocks. Thus, they got a police station and 6 blocks. That's what I heard on a report. Protesters took over 16 blocks in a major U.S. city. The governor and the mayor are doing nothing to stop it. They're just allowing it to happen. I mean, I would have no problem sitting in the military. I would start with an airstrike to let them know I mean business. But this happened before. This same thing, they allowed white people to take over a park in New York City for like 3 months, called it Occupy Wall Street. They had a library and everything in this park, right? So this is something that they let white people do. Black people will not be able to do this. All black people, no way. This push, I couldn't figure out what the riots and stuff was all about because they didn't have any demands until this week when it seems like what they want is to defund the police. Defunding the police would be allocating funding that goes to the police to other areas and taking away some of the responsibilities from the police, but you'll be creating other departments. And one of the major things that they're pushing out there is they don't want police dealing with mental illness. I believe that drug addiction was added to mental illness just last year. So was video game addiction. So a good way for white people not to go to jail for this heroin they're using seems like to me that they don't have to deal with the police. Now they're going to send in some crisis intervention officers that or something like that. But either way, the mental illness, this also ties into the program that the president started like a year or two ago to have mental illness checks for people to stop the mass shootings and to also these mental illness checks will allow people to buy guns if they don't buy guns. So this seems to all be tying together at some point. NASCAR, no more Confederate flags at NASCAR, Black Lives Matter NASCAR. You talk about white people clowning. White and black hands shaking on the hood of the car. Like NASCAR has to have like one of the whitest fan base of all sports, and it's a huge sport. I personally wouldn't feel safe attending a NASCAR race with or without the Confederate flag. The U.S. flag, Confederate flag, don't see a difference. The definition of racism, still what I've heard about it, they do want to put in the word systemic, but they don't want to put in the words white supremacy. So therefore, to me, it's just going to be ineffective. I'm Malan.
May I be heard one more time?
Caller in Colorado, yes, ma'am.
Okay. Those are awesome insights from the previous caller. I did just want to bounce a question off of all the listeners. Considering my unfortunate, like, relationship with a white supremacist for a significant amount of time, I have noticed that there are certain tactics that kind of throw them off guard, and I was just wondering y'all's opinion about employing these at work. So a lot of times what white people will do is they'll make jokes and, you know, like racist jokes, like you guys are all aware, and those jokes will get more and more sinister. I'm thinking, you know, next time it's a joking atmosphere and they're making, you know, it's slowly starting to become more racist or more,
you know, uncomfortable in any type of way of just calling them a white supremacist. So when there is an anesthesiologist who makes a snide comment, I just jokingly say, oh, okay, you're a white supremacist, and see how they react. And a lot of times these people, when they hear that word, it's triggering for them. It's more so than racist. White supremacist kind of, it just kind of cuts them differently, and they start kind of going out of their way to prove that that's not who they are. So my ex-husband would do that and still does that to this day. And so just wondering if a good response would be just calling these people, oh, okay, you're one of those neo-Nazis. Oh, okay, you're a white supremacist. I see you. And just having them put the onus on them and have them try, you know, feel that uncomfortability. What do you guys think about that tactic?
Can I be heard?
Oh, I wouldn't do that.
I wouldn't do it. Because they may make you have to prove it, and you won't be able to prove it.
Mm. But I might be able to.
Pardon?
I might be able to. I mean, I'm an intelligent person, and I might be able to. I mean, I might not have heard them say something specifically about a black person, but I can use my words to make it more or less. Say that I have felt threatened by other disgusting jokes that I've heard from them. So, I mean, if worse came to worse, I could probably make it sound like I could prove it.
That's not sufficient enough in a disciplinary meeting. You have to prove it, period. And I'm not the smartest person in the world, but I'm just using logic. If you had that ability to prove a white person is a racist, then we wouldn't be having this program at all, because it wouldn't be logical.
Okay.
But I would not do that. I would not do that at all. That's a suggestion.
What if my response is that, oh, I was just joking, just like you just made that joke right there? That was my joke. Why can't I?
Well, you would have to prove that you were just joking. So in other words, the whole logic is of what I'm stating is, in order to solve a problem, don't make sure before you do that you don't create problems. In this case, it would be problems on you. The problems would be on you. So I would file that incident, and when you have your particular job meeting, biweekly or weekly, whatever that is, then you can bring it up in a question. If this policy of what I've been hearing going on in the operating room or whatever, then you can put it in terms of a question. But I would not, and I will repeat, I would not call a white person a racist, because you will have trouble proving it if they challenge you in that way, and they have done so. I'm talking from experience also, but I mean, I can't tell you what to do and what not to do, but but just as you asked for suggestions, and that's what I'm giving you. Thank you, ma'am.
Thomas, in New York, were you going to respond to that question about...
Yeah, I was just going to say, if it's at work, just if they're comfortable with it, pull out your phone and record it. You know? Hey, you know, you might even tell, hey, listen, let me hear. You're so funny, let me record some of this. Let me get some of this material. And I guarantee you they'll stop. And if they do, you could go straight to HR with that. They you got it on tape, but like the firefighter said, it is almost impossible to, the only white person right now that you could call a racist is Donald Trump, and that's because other white people call him a racist. It's impossible for us to prove someone's a racist. We need white people to prove it, or we need to have direct documented evidence, which you would have if you have it on tape.
Might want to be careful.
But I'm not... Hello?
We can hear you. Yes, ma'am.
I'm not trying to make an accusation per se. Like, I'm not trying to get into an argument. I'm not trying to, you know, I don't know. I'm not trying to prove anything to them or to myself or to other coworkers. I'm just trying to at least get a little bit of offense instead of always playing defense. And I think if I'm making it a joke, like they're, you know, constantly in joke mode, and it puts them in that defense of trying to pander and not and prove that that's not what they are.
We're not in an offensive position. We're in a defense. We're in constant defensive position. We at war and they are winning, and we have no real defense to their war. So we're in a constant defense. You have no offense against them. Unless you can get them to prove it themselves, it's your word against theirs, and good luck with that.
Okay. I just saw it do a number in relation with a white supremacist, you know, that I was unfortunately married to, and I got to see a whole lot of backpedaling and, you know, pandering and that kind of stuff. But probably in the context of workplace, it's probably not a good idea. So I appreciate it.
You can accomplish what you're looking for, I think, if it's to get them to stop making those sort of crude remarks and racist jokes and that sort of thing. The accusing white people of being a racist, what I was going to say, you might even have to be careful about saying that Donald Trump is a racist, because I think some other folks have tried that, and he's pretty staunchly said, oh, no, I'm not a racist. Me and Kanye are thick as thieves, metaphor. But, in a workplace context, white people generally get very serious and unifying that regard. I mean, they've had situations where, you know, somebody called the person a nigger or all kinds of things. I know he had a nigger. I mean, called you a nigger, and he had a Klan outfit. It looks like that might even be shaped in the form of a lynching rope. But I don't think Mr. Cruz is a racist. They'll have a lot of that sort of thing. So I think it's just been so many examples where they end up, even the black, like I just mentioned Kanye West, he called George Bush a racist after Hurricane Katrina, and then he had to come back and apologize. Like, they waited like 4 or 5 years, they kept bringing it up and bringing it up. Didn't you call him a racist? Why did you say he's a racist? Yeah, I know he didn't respond, but you called him a racist. George Bush is not, and then he had to come, I'm sorry, and George Bush is not a racist. Matter of fact, he didn't even call him a racist. He just said he didn't care about black people, and they made him come out and say, I'm sorry, George Bush is not a racist. They end up getting a lot of black people in trouble for that.
Just to clarify, the word that I want, the term I want to say is white supremacist. And I'm trying to, do you know of any examples of a black person saying it in a joking form and it's still having, you know, oh, you know, I don't know if you guys are listening necessarily, like what I'm trying to say. Like, racist to me has lost a lot of its potency. So white supremacist, using that term but saying it in a joking fashion just to see their response, that's really what I'm wanting to try next time, and just as an experiment, just to see how they react to that. But if it's not a good idea, then, you know, I'll move forward accordingly. But if you have any examples of, like, a black person saying it in a joking way and noting the response of black people, that's really what I'm interested in.
They generally don't joke about that sort of thing. Like, they generally get real serious about, do what? Are you saying that I'm a, like, they generally get real serious about any sort of suggestion or allegation that a white person is a racist, white, and especially if you're going to say white supremacist, like, oh, man, like, they might tell a lot of racist jokes, but they generally do not joke around about that one. They generally get very serious, and you see them a lot of times work together against the black person who said that. I think you can accomplish the same effect when they make that, like, you're there and they're making the racist jokes or what have you. Thomas in New York, I think he said, with the recorder, just asking them to repeat it. I didn't quite hear what you said. Could you say that again, please? With a serious face, like, you don't have to be mad, angry, scowling, just, oh, could you say that again, Bob? I didn't quite hear you. Just make sure you can repeat it so I can hear it all the way. Even that, I see, can have a huge impact, like, whoa. Policy and procedure, you can write that down and just go by, I don't know. Do you think that violates the policy and procedure? Check that out. I'm always a big advocate of checking policy and procedure, but there are a lot of that accusing a white person, even jokingly, right, being funny, like, oh, you're a racist. Generally speaking, The examples that I've heard of that sort of thing, white people get very serious, and I've seen a lot of examples where it works out to the detriment of the non-white person. But you can let us know. Counter-racist codification, if you want to try out some different methods of responding, let us know which ones work out. Lots of folks have encountered that, though, white people being kind of racist and flippant in the workplace. And I think a few people have even, just noted being serious. When they see you consistently not responding, you're not getting upset, and or looking like you are being serious. What did you say? Could you repeat that? Make sure I write that down. Just that sort of conduct has been enough to, whoa, I think I'm going to stop making these comments around this person. I don't quite know what's up with them. We got all this, I'm going to be a little more cautious with what I say. I've heard a lot of folks who said that that type of response has worked very well at alleviating the behavior and making a much more professional workplace environment. Anywho, Workplace Racism, Fridays, 8 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Mountain, 5 p.m. Pacific. What a wacky week. I guess we can take one final. Does anybody have a last comment before we conclude compensatory call-in for this week? Last comment, about 30 seconds.
Yes, sir. I would say there is no workplace more laden with that type of behavior on a 24-hour basis than the fire service, which is what I did for 28 and a half years. So, and everything that the lady was talking about as far as the problem, I have experienced, and I have reacted, and I've gotten results. I've reacted in a way that I explained to bring it up at the general meeting. In our case, it was called battalion meetings, and bring it up, and from there will be a talk on it, and they would have to. They would have to, in most cases, go by what is on that paper. And so that would be my suggestion. Hopefully you don't go and quote unquote joke about them being white supremacists. I don't want you to get into that kind of problem. Thank you.
For sure. Policy and procedure, always a big advocate. I would even check that too. Just regardless of, which tactics you try out in the workplace, if you're, seeing what's going to work out, check the policy and procedure to see what's there in the manual. That's always a helpful tool in the workplace, especially now, because I know in a lot of work environments, policy and procedures are being or have been updated. So check, see if it has anything to say about appropriate comments and the like. That can be a helpful source.
Disparaging comments.
Can be a useful guide on how to phrase things, or even a great reference. You can just have the policy and procedure manual with you and reference, page 52 talks about this sort of thing. Appropriate workplace commentary behavior. Anywho, we should be here. Just check Black Talk Radio Network, the Facebook page. I think the iTunes feed should be working. I know some folks reported that they had some difficulties, but I tried it today. It was working. Even the links that they said specifically weren't working, and they worked for me. I don't know if it was, specifically for me, or if it's kind of a intermittent problem, but it seemed to be functioning today. We'll see if we can have all of the links for the program today posted promptly. I think we're current except for today's broadcast, but we should be available at SoundCloud, iTunes, Black Talk Radio Network, YouTube, Google Play, lots of platforms. If anything, if you have more folks who are receptive to racism, white supremacy, now would be a great time to have a list of information to share. You can have specific COWS programs or just links to the COWS period, other broadcasts that you think are constructive, there are films, documentaries, books, articles, magazines, anything that you can think of. If there are non-white people, especially younger people, if they're receptive and wanting to get a deeper understanding as opposed to just the police mess over black people, like what is it that keeps causing these type of events to happen? Be prepared. I think some folks had sent me some messages asking about books. I think I've said pretty consistently, talking about books that I think I've mentioned quite a few this program today even. I think Harriet A. Washington, Medical Apartheid, and her other book, Terrible Thing to Waste, great. Dr. Marumba Ani, Yorugu, Dr. Welsing's The Isis Papers, lots of the... Ralph Ellison, The Invisible Man, which features a riot after the police shoot and kill a black activist. They even steal a police horse in Invisible Man. A listener reminded me of that today. Like, man, oh, man. Invisible Man is all about racism, white supremacy. There are tons of books that have constructive info that you can be checking out and reading if you got folks who are receptive or are saying, hey, I'm asking more questions. You know, caller in New Jersey, you seem like you're a little less confused. You're talking about all this. You seem like you're a little bit racist in thinking about white people, but, you know, help me understand all this. Have some information ready to roll. If it's YouTube links or whatever, I've even told some folks you can have like a thumb drive or whatever it is or a folder where you can just, bam, shoot them an email or whatever, text message. But have some information prepared. If you have victims of racism, students, really, who are ready to learn. With that, we will be back. Well, it should be before the book club, so you just have to check. But take care. Black self-care, that is a revolutionary act right now. Stay safe and really put a high regard on your health. That, man, in this environment where it's so dangerous and black people are being harmed, terrorized, killed all over the world right now, really prioritize your health, prioritize getting a lot of quality rest, eating well, taking great care of yourself, drinking lots of water, getting some exercise in, really make that a priority. That is the protest. Directly connected. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. We need every possible cell of our brain computer working at an optimal condition. We are going to need high level thinking to solve this here problem. In addition to staying sober, really, I know it's reopening and it's almost summertime, so it's like, man, it is time to get out and do it to it. Make up for lost time. We missed out on the whole spring, I know. Under these conditions, I would be real strategic. It is not really time to be out just joyriding and I'm just going to have fun, be out with my friends. Like, let's slow all that down. There are a lot of armed white people. There's a lot of confusion, and it seems like the Rona is still real. Retired firefighter, that's 2 weeks where he's had to report a friend has passed away. There are lots of dangers, mostly, primarily, racist man, racist woman, racist child, but there are lots of dangers. If you are going out, it should be real strategic, and I mean really. Be alert. Like, if it looks like anything could be around. I'm here in Seattle. I have never been more terrified than here in Seattle. Like, total war zone. If it looks like, whoa, something just doesn't look right about this. This looks unsafe. Call it. We will wrap this up. Try this again when things are safe. Let's be vigilant about things that are happening, who is around us, what is going on. It is a really dangerous, as it was said, confusing time on the planet. If you're going out, you're going to be sober, buckled. If you are driving, you are not on the cell phone. Again, you got a lot of armed race soldiers. Many of them don't even have a badge. We want to try to minimize any attention, unnecessary contact with any of them. Little things, just the little things that we can do. Staying in the house would be a big one, but if you got to go out, the little things that we can do to try to minimize contact amongst very, very dangerous times worldwide. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person, remind us to prioritize self-care. Get your rest, eat well, drink lots of water, do not binge on news content of black people being terrorized, get the information that you need, take breaks, make self-care a central part of your counter-racist activities. Context of white supremacy signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.